Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Now, Mr. Fuller, we have a person in the chat room, and this person is asking a question.
Yes.
They're saying that on page 64 of your book, you stated that we should buy land. And if we can, with racial dislocation, what's the most effective way to buy land given racial dislocation is inevitable?
Oh, you just buy land. See, all of these entries in the code book, the counter-racist code book, are suggestions, and they are conditional. It depends on what the conditions are of the people who is reading, of the person who is reading the book at the time and place that he or she is reading the book, and then what it is the person is trying to do at that time and place. Now, that wouldn't apply to everybody in all places at all times. Some places you wouldn't want to buy any land because you can look around you and see that this land isn't of any value whatsoever, or it won't be for any time soon for what my needs are. See, it always comes down to the individual. That's why it's called a united independent. You're united, theoretically, in what you're supposed to be doing, and that's trying to produce a product called justice and peace, ultimately. But you, as an individual, you have to function every day. So that suggestion about buying land is just a suggestion to put that idea in a person's mind that, if you're going to buy something, if you are able to do so, buy some land that you can use for a, like I said before, constructive purpose. Now, if you don't see where you can use this land for a constructive purpose at the time and place that you selected to buy it, or if you don't see any future use for it, and you can hold it that long, then you simply don't do it. See, it's all conditional, because the conditions change, because we're still under the system of racism, and the races, like you mentioned before, this dislocation, the races may decide, well, what I'll do is I'll open some dams up the river, and when that person buys this land, I'm going to let the water out of this dam, and it's going to flood that person's land 300 miles downstream. The person doesn't know this, but that's what I'm going to do as soon as they buy it. And it's going to be worthless, because they're not going to be able to do anything with it but go boating. They bought it for the purpose of growing crops, but all they're going to do is be able to look at it and admire water, or go boating on the water. Because I'm not going to allow any fishing in that area. That's what you mean by being supreme. You can make these decisions that can jerk people around ad infinitum. If you're going to dominate people over a long period of time and do it in a scientific manner, one of the easiest ways to do it, if not the easiest way, is to keep the people confused. So you keep confusion going. Dislocation is one of the major ones now. keep people moving, because they have found out over a period of time that people who are constantly forced to move from one place to another, either the water is rising and they have to move, or in some cases, the water is not rising, but the prices are rising in the area where they are, and they can no longer stay there because they can't afford to be where they are. So they raise the prices on everything. They foreclose on the house that a person is in. That person has got to move. Because they have found that when people are constantly moving, they are dislocated. And they are angry and they are frustrated and they can't get their bearings. They can be almost driven insane by having to do that. And then they become completely dysfunctional.
Well,
and then they are totally vulnerable. So that's one of the major strategists for misusing people. Keep them on the move. Dislocation, racial dislocation. It's called racist dislocation confusion.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, January 31st, 2018. So I have been told. It has been some weeks. I think one of the longest breaks that we have had in the broadcasting tenure of the context of white supremacy. A little over a month and a half. Also keeping in mind that we were off the air from 2007 until 2009. So we certainly have had significantly longer breaks, but definitely one of the longest breaks in the time that we have been on the air. It'll be 9 years next month, 9 year anniversary. Back just in time to celebrate. I am not things have not changed that significantly since we were last on the air, December 11th, 2017, unfortunately. Things haven't changed that significantly, but one of the things that this long layoff did make me recognize just the amount of effort that I've been able to invest, for better or for worse, problem has not been solved, so it has not been effective enough. It has not been substantial enough, but at least the investment of time and energy towards solving the problem of racism, white supremacy, has been pretty consistent over the last 9 years to have not really had significant time off the air over that period of time. Was enough to make me say, wow, we've been consistent with the effort, if nothing else, over the last few years. We do have a guest for today's program, Mr. Randy Shrewsbury. He'll be joining us in about 50 minutes. He'll be here. That'll be an interesting exchange, but I did want to take time just to discuss what has transpired over the last month, because I was not on social media. I was not on email. My house was flooded on December 10th. We did broadcast the following day, and I don't think I said anything about the flood, and I did not have any intention at that time of taking any significant time away, but it was just, it was way beyond the flood. The flood in and of itself would have been enough to shut things down, at least to get that in order and to rebound from that. But it was just a plethora of just nastiness for about a month and a half, which just continues. Trying to even recap to put this in summation and to put this within the context of white supremacy and to start with Mr. Fuller's commentary on racial dislocation. I thought that was so important because everything that he talked about, that's what the last month and a half has been. It can drive you crazy. It puts you in such a vulnerable position when you have to pick up and move and you're unsure about where you're going to be resting, and particularly something that is of no fault of your own. We spent a lot of time on this program talking about Katrina. This was not a rain flood. People think of Seattle and rain. No, this was not rain. This was not snow. This was not a river. This was total man-made ineptitude. A city water main burst and flooded our residents. Right. So this was, I mean, it was extraordinary just to witness, to be inside on a Sunday evening and then to go outside and just see an ocean of water just flooding onto the property and flooding the residents. It was overwhelming. And then to have white firemen enter the residents and say, oh, yeah, we've had to shut off the water to the residents and the flood and everything. And the whole premises must be evacuated. You got to get out of here. Like, wow. Wow. Fortunately, none of my items or property were damaged by the water or any aspect of the flooding. It was about a foot of water entered the residence, and all of my property and my living space is not on the ground level. So I was not directly impacted by the water, but obviously I had to vacate the premises and still have not been able to return. No date in sight. Could be August. Who knows when we're able to return to the premises. That was the initial dislocation incident. Okay. So then after that, and incidentally, this is just kind of a rough estimate of how things transpired. So after that, I broadcasted the next day. We had Darlene turn on the air to talk about very important subject matter, racism, white supremacy, and the maternal mortality rates for Black mothers. Great information, important program. While we were doing that broadcast, the Red Cross came to meet with victims of the flood. That's another thing that I found out during this whole ordeal. No problem at all with you referencing yourself as a flood victim. You can say that and white people will come and empathize with you. And oh, these are the flood victims. Oh, this is just terrible. And no problems, no challenges. No, what are you doing talking about you? You are a flood survivor. Don't you walk around here saying you never, no problem at all. It's only when you are a victim of white supremacy, racism, then there's a problem with the V word. Anyway, while we're doing the program that Monday, December 11th, Red Cross individuals come to meet with flood victims. They are literally giving away money. And other flood victims, they laugh with glee and say, yes, while you were doing your broadcast, the Red Cross was literally here handing out money to flood victims and you missed out. Oh, well, continuing from that, Wednesday, December, I think that was December 13th. We were supposed to have a program that day. I got sick that morning. I had outstanding friends who came immediately when the flood happened and were there to transport me away from all of the ugliness. And they got groceries for me and the whole nine were super helpful. Lots of people that were super, super helpful. Non-white people. Black people, super helpful during the whole ordeal. But I got sick, unfortunately. Some of them were sick, and I got sick too. So that was kind of the breaking point in terms of me saying, hey, I think I'm not going to be able to broadcast until I am at least stabilized somewhat. I ended up being sick for about 10 days, so to be flooded out of your residence and sick and displaced, staying, you know, other side of town. It was just a bit much. It was way overwhelming, way overwhelming at that point. I was, as I said, sick for about 10 days. I just started to feel better around December 24th. And this is the point when I was beginning to feel extremely overwhelmed. The Red Cross, they provided literature. They gave us a pamphlet. And it has information and contact numbers and resources just for folks, you know, who've been hit by disaster of some sort. And they had information in the back that talked about ways that you're traumatized, the PTSD of it all, and how you can be overwhelmed emotionally and being displaced from your residence, and just all the different things that apply and things that you should try to do to combat that. I thought very helpful information applicable with regards to racism, white supremacy as well. But around December 24th, I was starting to feel a little bit better. And trying to, you know, push forward with the situation. You got to talk to insurance people and all that. And the whole ugly process, trying to figure out how long, you know, we're going to be out of a residence. I was going to take a shower. It was actually December 23rd. It was midnight. So it's just turning December 24th, which was also a Sunday. I go to take a shower. I'm in a hotel. I turn on the hot water. No hot water. I ring down, I call the concierge front desk folks, and they're like, oh, we'll send someone over right away. We'll get it, you know, taken care of. A couple minutes pass, person comes, they check it out, they fiddle around, they mess around with the hot water heater. About 5 minutes later, still no go, no hot water. He exits, and I go sit down on the couch, and I'm looking around. I'm still not feeling like from a health perspective in terms of having a cold. I'm still not feeling 100%, but I'm a lot better. I would have felt even better if I had been able to get that shower. I sit down and I'm already just following logic. It's Sunday. It's December 24th and it's about 12:30 a.m. I already know it's impossible that anyone is going to be able to come and correct this problem now or anytime soon, probably until Tuesday, the 26th at the earliest. Thank you, White Horror Days. So I'm already following the logic. I'm going to have to move again and at 12:30 at night if I'm interested in a hot shower anytime soon. I sit down at this point, and I think the only thing that I could focus on was self-care. I tried to brush my teeth that same weekend, and it took me about 30 minutes, and I timed it. At about the 15-minute mark, I was so frustrated, I looked at the clock to measure how long it had taken me to locate my toothbrush top. 15 minutes of looking, failed. 30 minutes, I finally found my toothbrush top, and that became like a symbol for the whole process. Self-care, I'm going to focus on just self-care. If I can brush my teeth, if I can floss, if I can just take care of Gus T, that will be my only priority for the day. I'm not doing anything else. And that became crucial, because all of the things that Mr. Fuller talks about with racial dislocation, it can drive you crazy. He's not talking about necessarily a flood. It can be anything, as he was saying in the examples where they price you out. Racists, they have a variety of different methods. But I mean, why to experience all of that acutely with the flood situation? Wow. All I can say is making self-care a primary facet of counter-racism, a primary facet of your existence and what you prioritize, it is critically important. And I am appreciative. I think some of the words of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., Dr. Kamau Kamban, many of the folks that we've had on the program, How It All, Tracy McWhorter, I believe is her name. We had her on the program. She did great work about Black people eating healthy, taking care of ourselves. I'll make sure to get the book and the title. She was a guest on the program some years back, but perhaps a few of their bits of wisdom, planting seeds, as we say, stayed with me during this experience, but whoo, I can tell you it was an assault on self-care on so many levels, because after I was out of the residence, right? And I said, tons of people, super helpful, groceries and the whole nine to help out and cookware to use while we're out of the house and everything, just super, super helpful. But also with that, came offers food, right? where people would come by, oh, we brought you some food. Here's pizza, chocolate chip cookies, and fried chicken, that sort of thing. And I mean, I'm not trying to come out as some sort of food snob. I have had my share of fried chicken over the years. I've had my share of pizza over the years, too much, in fact. I'm not, you know, trying to talk down to anybody about food. I'm just saying that, and it was consistent. Some of the other flood victims would stop by and say, hey, let's, you know, try to go get something to eat, you know, so we can hang out for a bit and not have to feel bad about, you know, being dislocated and what have you. Like, okay, yeah, let's go get something to eat. Where do you want to go eat? Let's go get fried chicken. and it kept happening so consistently where I was like, man, are we being punished? Like I said that literally, like, are we being punished? Like we've been banished from where we live? Like we got to be punished to have bad food too? And I just kept saying that over and over again because it was just, and it wasn't necessarily bad in terms of bad quality, but it just wasn't food that's going to nourish your body. It's not eating in a healthy manner. This is easily is a situation that can make things way worse, where sitting around and eating chocolate chip cookies and ice cream and pizza and feeling bad about being flooded, which is a, you know, certainly something to feel bad about. You could end up gaining 25 pounds and make a horrible situation way worse. And I saw that very early on, like, oh man, that's exactly what could happen in this situation. And I think one of the very early times that food was recommended, we were going to go out, let's eat. And they said, where do you want to go? I said, let's go get Ethiopian. Always loved Ethiopian food. Loved it. I was eating Ethiopian food before I came to Washington State, but it happens to have a pretty sizable population of Habesha here, and they have a lot of Ethiopian spots. Let's go to Ethiopian place. We go. I know they have great veggie combos, so I can get something with a lot of vegetables that'll be very nourishing spiritually, physically. I'll feel good, and I won't have to, you know, scarf down fried chicken and pizza and all this other stuff that is just going to be terrible for me, you know, on many, many levels. We go get Ethiopian. It's great. Everybody loves it. Like, it had been a minute since I'd been to an Ethiopian spot. I got to try out a new place. It was just outstanding. It was so good, in fact, I went to get Ethiopian again the following day. When I went the following day, gorgeous Habesha female, she was the owner, and she was the person who was actually serving the food as well. That's been another pattern that I have observed, another reason that I always love going to Ethiopian spots. They tend to have just gorgeous black females working there as well. Fit the pattern. So I went, and when I went to get my food, I got the veggie platter. That's what I always get, because when I started, when I was introduced to Ethiopian food, I was vegan. So that's all I got. I've never even looked at the meat side of the menu. I wouldn't know what to tell somebody who was a carnivore what to eat. Even after I stopped being vegan, I would still just get the veggie combo because it was so delicious. So that's what I got. And she said, oh, are you vegan? And I said, no. And she kind of looked at me and she's like, oh, okay. And we just continued with the conversation. It was great. Another seed planted. As this ordeal continued, I regressed to being vegan. Major part of what happened with the whole ordeal. Major part of just self-care. As I said, I was just seeing that onslaught every day of just bad food and feeling bad and the trauma of all this, and it going from, oh, the place flooded, maybe we'll be able to move back in January, February. Oh, maybe we'll be able to move back in July. Oh, maybe we'll be able to move back in September. The ever expanding timeline, just all of that. It was so easy to follow the logic and see how, wow, this could just end up being a situation where everybody feels really bad. Everybody is really sad. We're not taking care of ourselves. We're eating bad food. Like, let's try not to do that. Let's try not to do that. Like, vegetables, lots of vegetables. Let's try to eat as healthy as possible. So that was major, at least for me, in terms of self-care. And I started doing a lot of yoga. In fact, that, I think, brushing my teeth, I couldn't find my toothbrush top, brushing my teeth and doing yoga, that became about all I was interested in even thinking about for days, days, days. That pretty much was about all I could do in terms of just keeping my sanity in an absolutely horrible situation that continues to be horrible. As I said, I could only be thankful. None of us had to stay under a bridge. Super, super thankful about that. Non-white people, extremely helpful in that regard. Our non-white landlord, super, super gracious, went above and beyond to help out all of the non-white people involved and making sure everybody was stable someplace while trying to sort out all of the madness in all of this. But, I mean, it's just been, as you can imagine, being displaced in such a manner and then having to move repeatedly several times and all of this, as you can imagine, it's just been stressful, as Mr. Fuller detailed comprehensively. But just really focusing on self-care, at least for me, huge, at least in terms of just trying to feel as good as one can in moving through all of this, just trying to deal with it as best you can in all of this, despite of how ugly everything has been. Just trying to at least find something in terms of this is going to be constructive for me long range. I think not eating all of those terrible foods and just eating vegetables and all that, I think it's been much more helpful for me. This was the diet that I was on when I first came to Seattle, when we started the whole Context of White Supremacy radio program. That was what I wanted to talk about. I'm sure it's in the archives. I was saying I wanted to talk about vegan cornbread recipes and all of that. All I can say, anytime if you have some sort of major stressor in life to the best of your ability, and it is certainly difficult, I can attest to that, because people will much more readily bring you pizza, fried chicken, chocolate chip cookies. It's much easier and oftentimes it's much cheaper to get that than quality, healthy produce, fruits, vegetables, that sort of thing that is going to build your body up, that is going to make you feel better, that's not going to tear you down and have you feeling just awful after you eat all that awful food, have you feeling twice as bad about your pitiful predicament. One thing I can add as well with the whole yoga thing, and again, some of this was just regressing. I did a lot of yoga when I lived in California. Like every day, I went to a studio and did yoga on my own. It just happened that here, when I was displaced, they put me in like the most hipster areas of Seattle possible. Like, I lived in Seattle before, but I did not live in the most hipster parts of Seattle. For people that are familiar with the city, when I was first dislodged, I was staying in Queen Anne. This is like Seattle and Washington State on the whole are very white areas. Queen Anne is even more white than the rest of Seattle. Well-educated, young, single white people basically live in this area, very close to downtown. It's basically downtown Queen Anne. If you're in lower Queen Anne, you are literally right under the Space Needle. You can walk to downtown. I mean, depending on where you draw the boundary, lower Queen Anne is a part of downtown, just depending on where you draw the boundary. Anyway, so that's where I was during the first portion of the displacement, where they've got, you know, Whole Foods, grocery stores everywhere, no idea of what a food desert is. You can walk to about 7 different grocery stores in less than 15 minutes. And they had yoga studios everywhere. That's what, again, planting the seed. That was what that was constructive for me, being able to just get some exercise. And a lot of yoga is about self-care. That has been said many times as I have been practicing self-care and taking care of yourself. And that's a big part of what the practice is supposed to be about. But just being in that environment reminded me, oh, yeah, I will go do some yoga. And they had so many, such a hipster white area. They have almost a yoga studio on every corner. And so many of them, you can, you know, go for a week for free and try it out. You can try 3 classes for free, that sort of thing. So, I mean, you don't have to spend very much money, if at all. You can go to a bunch of different places, try it out for a good 3 weeks or so, and get a lot of great exercise in, which is exactly what I did. It's been fantastic. Other than the massive trauma and displacement of the flood, like, I feel outstanding. I had some days where I went to 2 yoga classes, some days where I went to 3 yoga classes. And it has been, in addition to getting a lot of great exercise, a phenomenal study in white supremacy. Wow. To go to these yoga studios that are in super, super white areas where it's going to be like 90% white people. I've been to yoga studios before, so I knew, you know, what to expect. But wow, to be oftentimes the only black male in the class, not always, but oftentimes to be the only black male. Wow. And to make sure that I am still on assignment, even though I was not on the air because I was thinking of Cal's listeners so many times, I would wear my Cal's t-shirt to yoga class pretty regularly. I've been doing yoga consistently for about 5 weeks, and I wore it. Oh, I wish I had video. I went to yoga on December 26th. It was 2 people in class. Everybody was still on the holiday nonsense, and it snowed here in Seattle. It snowed December 24th and December 25th. So not only were people on the holiday thing, they were all giddy because it was kind of a quote unquote white Christmas. I go to the yoga class in Queen Anne. This is December 26th. It's a total, including the instructor, of 3 people in the class. Myself, instructor, 1 other participant. It's 3 of us, and I'm wearing my Cal's t-shirt, which says, "Please respect me like a white person." The instructor does not say a word to me for the entire class. Like, she goes, she talks to the, it was a white guy. He was the other participant in the class. She goes and is talking to him and giving feedback. It's 2 of us now in the whole class. This is an hour, 2 of us. She does not say a word, which is totally fine with me. Like, no problem. I didn't go expecting, you know, us to be buddies or anything like that. But man, it has been a hoot. From that point forward, I've tried to wear my cow shirt as often as I possibly can to yoga class. That has provided just a myriad of wacky anecdotes. I went to a different yoga studio, still in Queen Anne, same general area of Seattle, but different studio. And I had my cow shirt on after class. This is heated yoga, so the temperature gets close to about 100 degrees. You have to forgive my ignorance. I can't do the conversion to Celsius, but extremely hot. So it's like 100 degrees. It's too hot to wear a shirt, so I didn't have my shirt on in the class, but I put my cow shirt back on after class. So I'm sitting down after the class. Racist suspect, white woman, comes over, and I'm seated on a bench, and she's standing up. And she says, "Oh, wait a minute. Let me see your shirt." And so I sit up so she can read the whole shirt. She reads it. Right on. I agree. Right on. And she says, "I just wanted to tell you that I was so impressed with you being in the class." And she said, "You know, just you're there. And I mean, you're not just a man, but like a manly man." And she does like the muscle pose, you know, when you're like flexing your biceps while she says this. And she says, "You were there and you were doing the poses. And I was just so impressed. I wanted to make sure I told you that." And I just, wow, that is so interesting. Thank you. And she went about her business. I said, I also think that that is a Welsing moment, a manly man. In addition to the cowbell. And the whole yoga environment, I think, is a whole lot of that. At any rate, my one side note for all of this, I had no idea. I've been in Seattle for some years now. I've never taken a yoga class. I never even thought of taking a yoga class while I was in Seattle. Having been taking yoga classes now, apparently there are quite a few black females who do go to yoga classes in Seattle. I had no idea. I thought it would be extremely white, all white people. In Seattle, I had a black male yoga instructor. Oh, extraordinary class. Loved it. One of my favorite classes. He was great. Super nice. Black female yoga instructor. I've never had a black male yoga instructor in my life. I've never had a black male, black yoga instructor, period, in my life, male or female. I've had both here and other non-white instructors. I think all the other people that I had ever had a yoga class with had been white prior to this time in Seattle, but that has been super cool to get that experience. And there are quite a few black females who take yoga classes. I had no idea. That would have been reason enough to go and check out one or two in advance. In fact, I thought of Thomas in New York. I was at a class last week. It was an evening class. Those tend to be a little more crowded. I don't generally like those. I generally have been going to the morning classes. Like today, I went to the 6:30 a.m. classes. I like those. They tend to be a little less crowded. Non-white female instructor, she was doing the 6:15 a.m. class. She said, I always go hard in the morning because I assume if you're up at 6 o'clock in the morning and you're here to do yoga, that you came to get down. So I go hard in the morning. So that's the one I prefer to go to. But when in the evening, a black female walked into the studio with a white male, I thought of Thomas in New York. And I was thinking in my head, this was class hadn't started yet. It was about 5 minutes before class. And in my head, I was thinking I had Thomas in New York's voice. And what are you doing? Come trading. I can't believe that. And wigging out in my head, because it was obvious that they knew each other. They were talking together as they were coming in. I mean, they might not have been like a couple or anything like that, but they obviously had some sort of contact prior to getting to the class. So they come in. And while I'm still in my head with Thomas's voice going through my rant about this, the black female hops over and she says, oh, can I sit next to you? I was like, oh, I reckon. She sits down. White male is scouring the room, I guess, trying to find his spot. And of course, he comes back and he sits on the other side of my yoga mat. So now they are, I guess, on opposite sides of me for the duration of the class. That was kind of a bummer, but then I also thought at least I'm splitting them up for the class. They won't get to be together for the whole class. But yeah, I had no idea. I do not recall seeing, when I lived in California and took yoga classes, I do not recall seeing lots of black females in class. I have seen way more here in Seattle, and I would have never thought, just based on the statistics and the fewer population of black people here, would have never thought that that could be the case, but it has been. Anywho, I will have to give updates as that progresses. I'm sure there'll be other moments of racism from the class. They even have a yoga workshop that's supposed to be run by a black female instructor that's coming up later this year that's supposed to address racism and yoga. I was gonna put that on my calendar. I just saw it today, and it was 6 o'clock in the morning, so I was not focused on trying to write down all this extra information, but I'll have to update if I'm able to attend an address. But at any rate, self-care, I can only continue to stress that. Make self-care an integral aspect. I think that's one of the ways that racism, white supremacy works, is to make it so that we do not have self-care. I know Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, she talked about black self-respect and how the system works to annihilate our black self-respect. I think a huge aspect of that, when black self-respect has been annihilated, self-care can be totally annihilated. And wow, I mean, if counter-racism is going to be successful, self-care has got to be a huge component of that. If you are feeling things getting really, really stressful, if you're going through a really traumatic episode, maybe that can be one of the things that you hold on to, that, you know, I'm not going to be able to focus on as much right now. I'm really going to make it a priority to focus on self-care. And I mean, literally, sometimes that can be as basic as, I'm going to make sure I brush my teeth twice a day. And for Gus T, literally, for some of those days in December and even into January, that was it for the day. All I'm going to make sure that gets done, I'm going to make sure that I brush my teeth twice, that I have kept up with my toothbrush in all of this madness, and that I brush my teeth twice today and floss. And just build from there as you can, as you get your strength back, as you get your energy back, as things kind of stabilize, just build from there. But I think that is a huge goal of the system of white supremacy, to get us in that position where we're not able or not interested or don't even think that we are worthy of self-care, black self-respect, really make an effort to hold on to that. And food, I cannot emphasize that enough. Again, the context of white supremacy came from Gus being vegan. I guess you can perhaps see if there are any notable changes if things continue and I'm on with being vegan for the rest of the time that we're broadcasting, any notable differences in how I sounded or what the program was like when Gus was eating meat as opposed to when he switched back to being vegan. You can note for any changes, but the food aspect is hugely, hugely important. If you end up, again, if you end up being in an acutely stressful situation for any reason, maybe you can make that one thing that I'm going to make that a priority. I am not going to load up on comfort food, as they call it, and just eat a lot of nonsense that I like just because I feel bad or just because I'm going through a difficult situation. And notice that immediately, if you are around other people who care about you, well-meaning, these could be family, friends, what have you, and, you know, I baked you a cake and I baked you a pie, I made you some brownies, brought you over, you know, 12 Big Macs. You can let them know, like, hey, I really appreciate it, but man, like, I do not want to gain 50 pounds in addition to whatever other hardship I'm having to deal with right now. I am sure me gaining 50 pounds is not going to help that situation at all. let's get, you know, better foods. If you want to bring me something, some fruits, you can pick out fruits that you like. You can let people know that in advance. That's what I started doing, just telling people, like, hey, I am, you know, reverting to being vegan. And I know we've had a lot of pizza together and ribs and the whole nine. I would appreciate if you want to bring me something. Spin, that happened too. Like, I said it and they brought spinach the next time instead of chocolate chip cookies and all that. I got spinach and avocados. Great. Making progress. And it doesn't have to be anything. But I mean, you can just tell people to try to minimize that sort of thing happening, because you can, man, it can make a bad situation way worse. You can add alcohol in that. I've never been a drinker, so that's not, you know, People know that about me, so that's not something that they would do. But I also saw in this situation with that, another one, very, very easy. Oh, you're feeling bad. Come on, man. Let's go get a drink. Or I brought you a bottle. And oh, man. And now you've made a horrible situation about 50 times worse. I observe that. That's the way the system of white supremacy is set up. Cannabis is legal here, so that's another one. You can just smoke every day and, you know, hey, you don't have to think about any of these problems or whatever's going on. Lots of different ways that are going to be ultimately, in my view, destructive, and are just not going to help, you know, your situation be any better. In fact, will probably make things like 50,000 times worse by the time it gets to the end. So I thought that was huge. I've kind of been saying that to myself every day and just making that a huge focus. Self-care every day, and trying to preserve the little bit of sanity that I can under the system of white supremacy for folks who, over the past, I guess it's been about 5 weeks since we were last on December 11th. If you emailed, tweeted, messaged on Facebook, or reached out in any other way, I closed the day that I got sick. When I woke up Wednesday, December 13th, I was sick that day, and I knew I was going to have to move that day to my quote-unquote temporary housing. Man, I shut everything down. I stopped social media, email, everything at that point. I just said, you know, I'm going to wait until I get better and then until things stabilize. So if you messaged at any point during that time period and did not hear back, it has been absolutely horrendous. If anybody, was anxious, thinking that Gus T, something foul had happened, that I was no longer in existence, or if anyone that was unduly worried, my apologies, but it definitely was a time to worry. I certainly was not in danger of dying. I thankfully did not have to sleep under a bridge at any point during that time. I actually, the irony of it all, again, I have been in some of the most hipster areas of Seattle that you could possibly be. I started in Queen Anne. I am now in Capitol Hill. For folks, again, if you know the Seattle area, people brag about living in Capitol Hill. I think the median house value in Capitol Hill, I believe, is $1 million. That was just in the newspapers recently in the Seattle area. Like, people brag about. This is also super convenient. You can walk to downtown from Seattle. I think you could walk to the University of Washington as well from this location. But yeah, the irony, during all of this wretchedness, I have been in some of the most posh white areas of Seattle. Anywho, our guest should be with us in about 15 minutes, Mr. Randy Shrewsbury. I believe he is a white male, a white man. However, if you look at his complexion, he's a little tawny, as they say. If you remember Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, when she used to talk about the way whites would chide former House Speaker John Boehner because of his complexion. He's a little dark, right? They would talk about saying he had a tan and that sort of thing. Mr. Shrewsbury, same type of thing. And I heard him in an interview where he said he's quote unquote Native American. So I don't know. That's, you know, important question to begin with. He wrote an article in the Huffington Post where he said that he was a racist cop. Those are his words, where he talks about his experience and being around cops who told all these racist jokes and what have you. That he'll be with us in about 10 minutes or so. So we'll prepare, hopefully, if folks have any questions that they want to ask of him. We've been rescheduling for about a month. As I said, I did not plan to have a 1 month hiatus, I guess, from broadcasting. That was not in the plans. I had thought, you know, just a week or so. And then, as I said, things kept happening and kept having to move, and the awfulness of it all just pushed things back. But doing the program today, I think next week I'm going to try to return to our normal broadcast schedule with workplace racism and the book club, compensatory call-in. I think next week we'll be ready to get back into the groove of things. But again, it has been extraordinarily difficult. Also want to make sure that I give out enormous thanks to folks who invested while we were not on the air. It's been about 5 weeks since we last broadcasted, and still we had a substantial number of folks who invested, went to PayPal and donated. Thanks for all the folks who helped out. Greatly, greatly appreciated. I hope the context of white supremacy continues to be worthy of your time and energy. And thanks to the folks who I did report on Facebook. I think I messaged about a week or so ago, just giving an update on a brief update on, you know, kind of what had transpired, and the folks who reached out with thoughts and prayers from there. Thank you as well. Some of the folks who contacted Mr. Scotty Reed. Thanks to Mr. Scotty Reed. Also, he messaged me to check in. He was doing wellness checks to make sure that I had not died since I had been absent for so long. Thank you to Mr. Reed for reaching out and letting me know that folks were concerned and contacting him just to get an update to, you know, see about my well-being. Gus was not well. I am not well now. Emphasize that emphatically. I am not well now. But thanks to the folks who reached out. And frankly, I have been in a very grumpy mood and continue to be in a grumpy mood now. The yoga has helped with that somewhat. But I mean, that's what I got my pamphlet right here. I was going to read some of it if I had extra time on the program. But I have been in a very foul mood for a lot of reasons. Just being displaced from, you know, your residence is more than enough. I've had sleep problems as a result of the displacement. I've hated all of the beds that I've had in the new places. I think I'm on bed number three now in places that I have stayed since the flood, and they've all been terrible. This one is a Tempur-Pedic mattress. They're known for making really quality mattresses. I guess this is the best of the three. I'm especially upset because I had just purchased a brand new mattress. I had just moved this past summer. I just purchased a brand new bed, brand new sheets. I have bamboo sheets on my bed at home. Bamboo sheets are extraordinary. If you've not had them before, I would highly endorse them, encourage, do some research, check it out, might be worth it. They can be a little pricey, but in my view, they're worth it. The people in general that have, in my experience, that have had bamboo sheets, they do not want to go back to the regular sheets. So missing out on my bed, and I specifically got them because I also was working on self-care at home and saying, hey, I want to make sure that I can get quality rest. I have not had quality rest for a huge portion of my time on the planet, and I think that has greatly eroded my quality of life. I want to make sure, or I want to invest and do as much as I can to get quality rest. And I got my bamboo sheets and my new bed. It was so great and comfortable, most comfortable bed I've ever had. And now I'm out of it, and now I've complained about every single bed that I've had since then. And it might not even be that they're terrible, but they are not as good as the bed that I have been sleeping on, my bed that I've been sleeping on at home. So I've been in a very bad mood. I have feared that I would not have as much patience. Generally, when I exercise, practice counter-racism, especially with other non-white people, I appreciate and try to have as much patience as possible. But I feared that with all of the stress and trauma of this, that I might not have as much patience as I generally would, which, you know, is logical, given, you know, the frustrations of all of this. At any rate, I will give an opportunity if folks have any comments or check-ins. I feel like I could do a whole class on the yoga experience with regards to racism. I feel like that in and of itself has been a study in white supremacy, just hearing the comments. I think the cliche when they say a fly being on the wall, just wow, hearing white people, and this is largely white women, talking just amongst themselves and planning and, you know, oh, our dog Blackie and how much we miss him and we're going to hang out with him later in the day, or they're talking about other workshops that they're going to have at the yoga studio. It's going to feature dark chocolate and champagne, and just fascinating, absolutely fascinating. As I said, I feel like I could do a whole broadcast on that environment, but another day I can update that as I continue to, you know, visit classes and what have you. Anyway, I have an audio clip I'm going to play. I'm playing this because Mr. Shrewsberry, being a former enforcement official who's talking about some of his experiences, the racism he experienced in his time on the force, reminds me a lot of Norm Stamper. Folks recall Norm Stamper. He's former enforcement official. He spent about, I believe, three decades, according to his testimony, toting a badge and a gun, mostly in California, but he was also the chief of the Seattle Police Department. He's been on this program countless times to talk about a myriad of different subjects, but always love his little anecdote about getting his nigger knocker. Mr. Shrewsbury reminds me a lot of Norm Stamper. So this is one of our older archived sound clips, but the feature, Norm Stamper, to prepare for our guest today, Mr. Randy Shrewsbury. Context of white supremacy. We will be back, and I think we should have our guest with us.
They don't kill this man. Oh, my God, he got to be dead now.
It's like assassination by video.
Justice for Ayanna Jones. The banner was flown over Detroit on Monday. The plane traveling between her former home on Detroit's east side and the prosecutor's office and police department downtown. 1 year after her tragic death at the hands of a Detroit police officer, no one has been charged.
Don't forget your nigger knocker.
I'm very lucky to be alive today.
Luina sat down with us this morning on Good Day New York, and he talked about moving forward after his incident and how it sent shockwaves throughout the city. Four white police officers beat and sodomized the Haitian immigrant inside a bathroom in the 70th precinct in Flatbush, Brooklyn.
One of the major complaints that has emanated from virtually every urban black community in the nation regarding police treatment is that the police, because they are racist and bigoted, are disrespectful, crude, and brutal towards black citizens. Many emotionally unstable whites are attracted to the job because the authority that is characteristic of the police role affords an opportunity for them to act upon these prejudiced, sick attitudes.
The cop, it said, pushed her against the wall, and her son was on his back at the time, and he raised up and asked, "What are you doing to my mom?" And the officer shot him while he was on the ground.
The car belongs to the Tolans. It wasn't stolen. Police say Robbie Tolan and his cousin were unarmed. As for the officer who shot him, he is white.
Well, in California, a white California transit cop who shot and killed an unarmed black train passenger is now a free man, and a judge's decision to let him out of prison early sparking some new protests. Well, a jury sentenced 29-year-old Jahanz Messerly to 2 years in prison for the 2009 New Year's Day shooting, but last week a judge released him after he served a mere 11 months.
The way we interact with police, I think, it seems like we really don't understand when we come in contact with enforcement officials what white supremacy means, that you are in a vulnerable position as it relates to white people. You have a lot less power than the white army anywhere in the world, anywhere in the known universe. And we seem to demonstrate that in a real pitiful manner when we come in contact with enforcement officials. Could you share your view on that?
Yes, and it's codified, too, exactly how you should act at all times, without exception, and that is comply, both by word and deed. Do what you're told. Get out of the car. I don't care what kind of names they call you and all like that. If you're told to get out of the car, get out of the car. If you're told to put your hands in there, put your hands in there. If you're told to halt, halt. I mean, these demonstrations after you have been killed make no sense at all. Shot in the back of the head while running, while fleeing. And woe is me. Police brutality over and over again, decade after decade. Stop playing. There's nothing to play with. Put your hands on top of the car. Put your hands on top of your head. Drop to your knees. Whatever you're told to do. For a very logical, and I'm going to emphasize, logical reason. You're in a vulnerable position. You're not in position to show opposition. And when you think that you're in position to, 99 chances out of 100, you are going to lose big time. Now, we haven't learned that by now. Then we need to take some more lessons. and have what I'm saying now repeated over and over and over and over and over and over again until it sinks in. Because of what? The evidence. The evidence shows that running down the highway with a helicopter overhead usually gets you nothing. Stolen vehicle. Barricading yourself in some type of house or hut and talking about you not coming out. The record shows you come out, dead or alive. And then people gathering around, throwing themselves over caskets over and over again, photograph after photograph. Mothers, aunts, cousins, homeboys with plenty of dreadlocks and tattoos, throwing themselves over Catholics, over caskets, coming by an open casket, rest in peace, on the fence, teddy bears, candle lights, speeches about something got to be done about it. Stop playing like you're tough when you're not. That's the message. You're a prisoner of war. Act like one. Name, rank, serial number, hands in there. You've been captured. Don't act like you haven't been. They've already got a make on you. Already got your fingerprints. You've already been computerized for life. Don't play like you have some kind of secret army, because you don't. You're alone. Three sets of blinking lights. Get out and do what you're told. And no lip. None. Prisoner of war. Show some intelligence. But even as I speak now, there's somebody out there who isn't. Driving down the highway 40 miles an hour, driving up in people's yards and all like that. They're going to be dead in the next 5 minutes. And the report's going to say, it looks like he was going for a gun. You already know that. Why act like you don't? Everybody out there who's doing that kind of stuff, who's within the sound of my voice, that's who I'm talking to. You know the routine. Don't play like you don't. We play too much. Play, play, play. Everything is a movie scene.
Very serious. About nothing. About not being very serious.
You haven't done anything? What are you running for? If you have done something, what are you running for? How far you think you can run? To the moon?
Police say they're looking into what happened, but deny any kind of racial profiling.
Don't forget your nigger knocker.
Let's see. Context of white supremacy. I'm trying to locate our guest. Let's see. Mr. Shrewsbury, how about this? He messaged me and said he was having some difficulty dialing in. Mr. Shrewsbury, if you're with us, if you could press *61, that way I'll be able to identify your line. If he's still having difficulties, I will ring him. But he he messaged me about 5 minutes ago and said that he was trying to dial in and he was having some sort of difficulties. He didn't say what the problem was, but looks like I gave the correct information, correct code. I see the other folks have dialed in, so we will give him a few more minutes. Again, Mr. Shrewsbury, if you are on the line, if you could press *61, that would be great. I can identify your line specifically, and we can get you on the line. If not, I'll give him a minute or two more, and then I'll give him a ring if I don't see him on the line. In the interim, while I'm giving him a second or two. Again, thanks to the folks who hung out. Thanks for the folks who tuned in. I thought all of the folks who have been disgruntled with Gus T in the context of white supremacy for however long that they have been, I thought they would be gleeful, like, grand, he is off the air. We don't have to hear that nonsense anymore. We can go about the serious business of solving this problem. For those folks, I guess they were elated for 5 weeks or so, but for the folks who, you know, were glad to see us back on the air or concerned, thank you kindly for the support messages. I am going to, as things stabilize, get back to catching up on email and everything else for the past 5 weeks or whatever it has been. We will get cracking on going through that, but it has been a tumultuous period. And I think most of the folks have understood that this sort of situation. And again, emphasizing, just out of respect, we did spend a lot of time going through Katrina. It was not that sort of situation at all. As I said, I think the maximum level of the water in the residence got to maybe a foot. So, you know, this was not any sort of harrowing experience like Katrina at all, at least not the flooding part. The displacement part, yeah, that probably has been kind of close in terms of the experience. Again, just thankful we've not had to stay under a bridge for any portion of this nasty ordeal. Let's see. I'm still not seeing Mr. Shrewsbury on the line. I'll double check and see if I'm going to end up needing to dial him for the broadcast here. Mm-mm. Yeah, hopefully he'll let me know one way or the other about the email. This is one of those I was more excited about when I thought this was a white person, someone accepted as white, no issues, as opposed to this could be someone who a significant number of folks classified as white do not accept as white, regardless of what stance he takes or what he says. I think that could be the case. I think that is very important to not be sloppy about racial classifications. That's something that I've noted. Racists, they take that very seriously. And just asking, and the fact that he said something about this in previous interviews, I did want to make sure to ask about that. But we'll see if we have him on the line here. Again, Mr. Shrewsbury, if you're there, if you could dial *61, that would let me be able to identify your line specifically. I don't have to wade through all the folks to figure out which one is you and which one is, you know, the other folks. Yeah, I'm going to give him about 5 minutes because I wrote him. I think it's been, you know, enough time if he was going to respond. I'll give him another five to see if he's going to respond or not. And I don't know, he may have bailed on us, may have decided not to participate, but I'm not seeing his hand on the line and he has not written me back. Hopefully we'll get a response in the next few minutes or so from folks. I did see we had some folks who dialed in. I guess we could take a question or two while we are waiting. Just making sure I'm not missing. Yeah, we'll take a question or two while we're waiting for Mr. Shrewsbury to get through. I even have hesitation about all of this. I guess I would also share, I'm not really one of those people who's into having to do a whole lot of chatting about themselves. So I was not really looking forward to having to come on to explain the flooding situation and what happened with all that. I'm really just disgruntled about the whole thing and then having to explain the whole thing. And it's just been, man, I do not have words. Then it has been absolutely overwhelming and disgusting every step of the way, other than not having to sleep under a bridge. Beyond that, it has been absolutely disgusting. So yeah, I was not looking forward to having to explain what happened with all of this and, you know, what's been going down for the past month or so. But, you know, moving forward, getting it done, just move forward as best we can. Let's see, Thomas in New York, I see you had a hand up. Do you have a comment while we're hanging out waiting to get to Mr. Shrewsbury?
Gosh, it's good to hear your voice, bro. Thank you very much for coming back. No, I was looking for you, Gus, man. I was looking at the paper. I'm like, yeah, this told Gus about Seattle. You know, I was about to call Vin Baker, who I think works at a Starbucks at Capitol Hill. Man, I made a big mistake, Gus. So I saw that I think you played a clip at the beginning of the show, and it sounded like Neely Fuller on Beverly D show. Well, either way, I saw Randy Short was going to be on Beverly D show, and I remember he was a guest on the couch. I didn't remember the conversation, though. I remember white guests better than black guests. So I called him, you know, I said, man, you know, Gus T. Renegade, I know you did the cows before, who's been missing? He says, that brother had a problem with me using the word coon. He said, I never heard of anything like this. I mean, it just totally went left field, Gus. I was like, oh, my God. But, I don't think he'll ever come back on the show. he remembered that. But other than that, Gus, I'm glad you're back, man, and I'm not going to harp on it. I'll mute my line. Thank you very much, man.
Wow. Woo! I have no words. I guess Gus T does have a problem with use of the word coon. No, I don't think it is constructive, but yes, at any rate, Mr. Randy Short, he has said other things that I do think are constructive. He was a guest on the program summer of 2015, right after, make sure I have my dates correct. So much is that. Yep, it was summer 2015. It was right after Michael Brown Jr. was executed in Missouri. A few weeks after that, August 2015, he was on. We talked about that, obviously, a lot, amongst other things, and, you know, the word coon. Great. Right on to Randy Short, the black female caller in New York. Did you have a comment that you wanted to get in? Are you with us, ma'am, or are you just listening? Might have got disconnected. I'll nab you if you get a hand up again. Let's see. Make sure I'm also not missing out. Mr. Shrewsbury, if you are with us, if you are able to dial in, let us know. You can press *61 if you're on the line. Mr. Shrewsbury, *61. That way I don't have to dig through all of the lines to try to, you know, identify you. So *61 if you're on the line, Mr. Shrewsbury, *61. Press *61 on your line and we will get you on with us. Black female caller in New York, did you have a comment you wanted to get in?
Yes, thank you, Gus. I mean, I haven't done this in so long. I disconnected myself. It's good to hear your voice. Can you hear me okay? Can I
yes,
be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yes, it's good to hear your voice. I'm glad to know that, you know, some of your listeners and callers, you know, were concerned about you. I, too, was so much that I bothered Pam. because I was like, what's going on? But I'm glad to hear that even though you're not at the optimal self that you are, you can say you are still here. And my mind went like real, real, real left because you were talking about possibly going to Cuba. I said, man, he got over there to Asada and they got him. But anyway, like I said, I'm glad to know that you're okay and you're not under a bridge. But I wanted to comment on what you talked about, how you were feeling, and how you were talking about self-care and how easy it is for us to not take care of ourselves physically when we're stressed and in situations where we're displaced or things that are brought upon us suddenly, how our eating habits are bad and we're not exercising, and this can further erode not only our health physically but our mental health. And I was listening to your words and how you things you were saying, actually listening to the words. And that's kind of our situation every day when we are not facing these types of situations. Just getting up and going to work. Are we really thinking about, I mean, a lot of times we have to really, really, really put in a whole lot of effort to think, you know what, I'm not just going to go out with everybody and go to lunch and just have pizza and what have you. And a lot of times we do this emotional eating. We do this emotional eating at work. We do this emotional eating at home. We have to pick up these kids. We have to do all of these things. And the last thing on our minds as people, as victims, is really taking care of ourselves. So while I'm not minimizing at all, your trauma is, you know, everything is relative. I would think I experienced that myself. We are all traumatized on some level. You know, unfortunately, you know, some of us have, you know, situations such as yourself where we're displaced. You know, we're attempting to be wives and husbands and parents, and it's just a traumatic situation in this system. So, you know, when you were talking, I just kind of saw that, like, across the board for victims of racism. Like I said, not trying to minimize your situation or anything, but anyway, I just wanted to chime in and let you know that I'm glad you're okay. All right. Thanks for taking my call.
Appreciate it. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Absolutely. The daily trauma of white supremacy racism. Absolutely. I think we have a lot of similar responses. And then you have more acute situations if it's, you know, a flood or whatever else racists inflict upon us, where it's a more acute incident of trauma. But you see a lot of the similar patterns. And just even being mindful of that on a daily basis, you know, if you're experiencing stress because of workplace, we haven't done workplace racism in some time. But if it's, you know, stress because of what's going on in the job or whatever other areas of life, just be mindful of that. Is that eroding your ability or your focus even on self-care? Because that happens a lot in this system, especially those acute situations. Absolutely. But even just the day-to-day wear and abuse of white supremacy racism, that has an impact as well. Mr. Shrewsbury, again, if you are with us, *61, that way I'll know it's your line. I'm checking my, have my email open as well, and I don't see email. Like I said, I emailed him. It's been about 10 minutes and didn't get a response. I asked him if he had a number where he wanted me to dial him to send me the number, and or he could try dialing in again, because it seems, you know, you all have dialed in without a problem. Line seems to be working, and I, you know, confirmed that I did give him the correct calling information, so shouldn't be an issue on that end as well. Let's see, other folks who dialed in. Ross, if you had comments you wanted to get in, sir, you should be with us.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Gus, man, it is so wonderful to hear your voice. Yeah, I was quite worried myself. I was getting bombarded with emails and contact from people as well. And it was Scotty. Thanks again to Scotty Reed, who updated me that, and all of us. And then I further just spread the word as I got it, that you were okay. Yeah, it just gave me a lot of pause for thought, because when you have someone that you listen to regularly, and a person who you feel some sort of kindredness with, which is what I feel with you, just from so much that I've learned from you in the show and the callers and whatnot, it really made me think just about, you know, not having you there made me think about what if that was the case, and just the importance of people, the importance of this show. And I really got that emphatically from just the different people who had reached out to me asking about your health and how you were doing and if you were okay. And it's wonderful to hear that you're doing okay. I know that you're not completely where you need to be, but it's really great to, I think your story was very important, just because, like you said, a lot of people, a lot of us, we just naturally fall into these patterns because that's just the way that we're groomed in the system. We're not groomed to stay healthy. So it was great to hear that you shifted your eating patterns. You got into yoga. That's wonderful stuff. And a lot, most Black people don't ever try yoga. They don't even think about that type of stuff. So just to put it out there, for you to be able to discuss how it has benefited you in such a traumatic situation, I think is really wonderful for other people to hear. It's something that is important. Self-care is of the utmost importance, so you can do the things that you were charged by the ancestors to do. I think what you discussed about the yoga studio on every corner was just a treatise in the system of white supremacy. Like, they make sure that they're okay. You know, in black neighborhoods, it's a liquor store on every corner and a church that's usually underserving the community, depending on, you know, who's running the church. But ultimately, just to hear that they put a yoga studio on every corner just means that they're dealing with their mental health, their spiritual health, all of those things that we end up taking for granted because we're under such duress and stress on a constant basis. So it was just really incredible to hear that. And then the story with Dr. Randy Shore had me cracking up too. You have some funny stuff in there, but I would just say thank you. It's wonderful to have you back. It's great to be able to just be back and be able to partake of the program. And I just want you to send you just some healing, positive vibes and irations to you. And hopefully you'll heal as quickly and thoroughly as possible. Thanks again, and I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. Again, thanks to Mr. Reed and yourself, Roz, other folks who were reaching out and trying to, you know, share with other people. I know Mr. Reed said he was, you know, trying to do the same thing to spread the word so that other people, you know, who were concerned or curious about, you know, what was up with Gus and the program and if I was okay and all that. So again, thanks to the folks who were spreading the word. I'm sorry Pam had to be bugged. I'm sorry, Pam. My bad. It was rough times on the plantation. I will make sure to apologize, get in contact with Pam myself. But yeah, it was good to get back. I was thinking about Cal's listeners. I was thinking about you all at various points going through different experiences, both with the flood and, you know, just various other things. Even to the point that Roz just said in terms of Seattle, I've been in Seattle for some years now. This experience with my house being flooded in Seattle, I live in Seattle proper. Even with that, in this experience, I concluded unequivocally, Seattle is the best city-plantation that I have visited, lived in the continental U.S. Now, I have not done a lot of international traveling, but most of the large cities in the U.S., I've been to. I've lived in Atlanta. I've been to L.A. I've lived in East Bay, California. I've been to D.C. I've been in New York City many times, Philadelphia, Chicago. Most of the big cities I've been to, Denver, Salt Lake City, blah, 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 blah. Hands down, it's not even close, in terms of most of the things that you would want, that you would consider valuable, like having a lot of things to do, easy access, just even as I said, like the hipster areas that I've been in. You can walk to about 6 different grocery stores. When I was in Queen Anne, you could walk to about 6 different grocery stores in about a 10 block radius. Walk within 10 minutes, you could be at easily 4 or 5 different grocery stores, all with quality, high level produce, affordable, some of it not so much, but affordable, you know, easy access to really quality foods right at hand. Even where I am now in Capitol Hill, there are 2 grocery stores on the same street that I'm on within 5 blocks. And if you walk the opposite direction, you will also bump into 2 grocery stores. I stopped counting. I think there are about 7 grocery stores in walking distance from where I am now. Not just yoga studios on every corner, just super accessibility to everything. Libraries. I don't think I've ever lived in a city from where I am right now. I could walk to 4 different public libraries. Walking distance. That's not counting the 20 plus Seattle public libraries that they have in the city. That's just the 4 that I can walk to from where I am right now. No contest. And the only reason they have all these resources, in my opinion, is because they have a very low population of black. They just opened that Amazon cashless store here. That happened while we were on hiatus. They opened that store up here. They were talking about that. That was all the big news. Like, clown, it is amazing the resources that they have in this city with very, very, very low population of black people. This caller in Florida, retired firefighter. Did you have a comment you wanted to get in, sir?
Greetings, Gus.
Greetings. Good to hear from you, sir.
Good to see you up to the point where you are able to get back with your program. We certainly appreciate what you're doing. And I know for me, it gives me a chance to share information and learn additional things so I can, in my own personal walk, share it with other non-white victims of racism, white supremacy. I think you were quite articulate and accurate in your analysis of what you find yourself
on the public.
Hold on.
Yes, sir.
In what you've quite accurate in what you been experiencing. I have witnessed it myself, not so much as a victim, but as far as the job that I retired from, as most people would know that about fires, you know, people's home burning down, but also, you know, with different other a gambit of disasters that your imagination can come up with. Normally, it's someone's property or themselves are harmed by it. And in turn, as you mentioned about the Red Cross, you were quite accurate as far as that concerned. I've seen it countless numbers of times. Personally, I have been getting letters in the mail. Got a couple of letters in the mail talking about the possibility of pipe water pipes bursting in and around where I'm allowed to stay at. And basically, it didn't make any sense to me that I would get such a notice from the Florida Power and Light Company on the issue. And I did seek advice and just told them just to stockpile the letters, but don't respond to them. They were asking for money, asking for money for some reason that there's a possibility your pipes can burst. Yeah, that sort of thing. That's when you were explaining about your situation. That's what it reminded me of. One thing that I think most of the people on the line know and understand that any one of us as a victim of racist white supremacy, and it reminds me of Dr. Francis Press Wellesley, that we can lose all of our quote-unquote possessions in a snap of a finger. And as you did mention, that there's a catastrophe of personal things that take place from such a calamity that happens to us. And as you mentioned, ultimately health would become an issue as far as that concerned. Being aware of it helps because you can possibly work in a direction that can stave off that getting to the inner self as good as you possibly can, as opposed to it just blindsiding you, you know, and the person not being aware of the circumstances. And both areas where I stay at and where I grew up at have been bombarded with displacement. Right now I'm standing in the yard of the home where I grew up at. And as you had this area on your program, Richmond Heights, and as the original homeowners, the average age probably would be in their mid to late 80s. Some of them approaching 95 to 100 years old. Of course, you know, they're steadily dying almost every day. And as they are leaving out, the children who grew up in the homes are not able to get the property at all. So that's an extension of what you were talking about. As far as that's concerned, and the area where I stay at, which is much more recent, the same thing is happening. And then we're not even talking about from a global standpoint where it's, you know, it's like almost a normalcy, I'll put it that way. So it just kind of like, gives added additional confirmation of how sophisticated in its viciousness that the global system of racism, white supremacy is, what it is and how it works as far as that concerned. So programs like this are necessary. And if Dr. Welsing, I mean, yes, Dr. Welsing has always told you at the end, at every time I've noticed when she used to leave off your program, she would mention how important programs like yours is, so victims of racist white supremacy can share and learn. And then, of course, when we hang up the phone with one another, we go off in our personal and private lives and institute that, what we learn and what we share. We can share that with other non-white people. And that's all I have to say right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Appreciate that. Absolutely, though, the racial dislocation, unfortunately, I think that's the reason why Mr. Fuller has been talking about that for so many different years and continues to talk about it when he says keep those squatters on the move. That is, you know, a major weapon, and it might strike in a variety of different ways, because I even, you know, during the time off, I was not spending a whole lot of time checking the news, as I said, some days brushing my teeth. That was the only objective. But I did see where that was being discussed, infrastructure problems and having more of this sort of thing happening. Even that train that derailed up in these parts last month, they were talking about that and saying that they didn't have the proper technology to check, you know, the train speed that could have maybe prevented that derailment from happening here last month. But that's going to be a big thing. And it would not surprise me if more of these infrastructure failures end up disproportionately impacting black people, non-white people. That would be something to look forward to in the future. But the dislocation and just having black people, lots and lots of black people worldwide, locally, nationally, globally, in that position of just being unsettled and destable, probably going to be lots more of that. Also, and I remembered the entire book By Any Greens Necessary, A Revolutionary Guide for Black Women Who Want to Eat Great, Get Healthy, Lose Weight, and Look Fat, P-H-A-T, fat, Tracy Lynn McWhirter. She was a guest on the program, I believe it was 2014, but great information in the book, great information on the program, and I think some of her wisdom, Miss Tracy Lynn McWhirter, some of that wisdom, I think, was with me during this experience to say, put those cookies down or reject those cookies outright and the pizza and all the other nonsense and see if you can get some greens, vegetables, fruits, things that are going to build you up. We have any other folks? I am concluding that Mr. Shrewsbury is not going to cooperate and visit with us this evening. I still am not seeing him on the line. I emailed him about 30 minutes ago. I think it's been more than that now, and I didn't get an email response. I didn't get any sort of reply, so I think he might be practicing racism, white supremacy against us and just wasting our time and showing up. And that's another thing. Like I said, I'm already in a grumpy mood to have this sort of nonsense. It would bother me anyway to have this sort of thing happening now, and particularly in this context. Like, we have been rescheduling for weeks to reschedule for weeks, and then for you to no show on the day of, like, come on, that is about as trifling and tacky as it can get under these circumstances. Like, wow, best you can expect from racist suspect. If any other folks that are with us, if y'all had.
Hey, Gus.
Yes, sir.
Did you see the article where it came out like 3 days ago where they said race, yoga is racist?
No.
Yeah, if you Google it, yoga and racist, you'll see it was a Michigan State or Michigan University professor who wrote a paper. You know, of course, white people are in an uproar. But it's pretty much saying that the fact that it was pretty much like what you were saying, the fact that you can see a yoga studio on every corner in a white neighborhood is, she was saying that's cultural appropriation, but, you know, that's just one of them cold words. She was saying that, you know, they're promoting health, the yoga pant craze and all this other stuff, all promoted to white people, not being promoted to black people. And the professor, I believe, is an East Indian. At least that's what her name sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, that is the system of racism, white supremacy. You certainly, that's, you know, that's what I expected to see here in Seattle. That's what I saw in California. I did yoga there. I went to studios there as well. That is what I saw. But, I mean, that's the system of white supremacy. It's not anything special about yoga. It's the same thing, I think, that was addressed earlier when they were talking about why you see liquor stores and all the other nonsense. You'll see that in non-white areas. You'll see things that are about health and constructiveness in areas where you have a lot of white people, even just banking institutions where you can go get a loan to start a business or some other enterprise, financial enterprise. You'll see that in white areas. That is the system of racism, white support, or grocery stores. You could say the same thing. Like I said, black areas that I've lived, I can't think of too many spots where you can say, yes, mostly black people live here, and you can easily walk to 6 grocery stores that have great, healthy, fresh products, reasonably priced, you know, easily accessible. I just don't think that that's the case in this part of the world too frequently. By design, system of white supremacy.
Now, what we have here in Harlem, Gus, that it's replaced. So the yoga, and I haven't seen this in any other place. In fact, the article came out last week, or this week it might have been. We were saying that Chicago is a pharmacy desert. However, I swear to you, I could take video footage. I have 9 pharmacies within like a 6-block radius. I mean, it's like they're drugging us to death here. And instead of getting us healthy using yoga studios, we just get a bunch of pharmacies.
That is the system of white supremacy. No surprise at all. I mean, anything that is going to be of health and constructive value, I mean, just that alone, just walking around some of the areas and seeing the types of businesses and services that they have and businesses and services that they don't have in these areas. I think the caller that was taught this, I guess, would be some months back, but we had someone who was talking about part of their counter-racist code is if they go to like, I guess, a bank or some other establishment, and they have like the really high security glass window between like the patron and the person, the employee, the person that's working there, what have you, to not shop at those type of stores or whatever it is, because it is reinforcing that institutionalized feeling that you are already in greater confinement for non-white people, because they tend to have those types of stores and what have you in areas where they have they're going to warehouse a lot of non-white people, especially black people. They don't have that sort of stuff here. Just paying attention to that, what resources they have where the white people live, what resources they put where non-white people live. You'll see it on a pretty regular basis, stark, easily. Were there other folks who dialed in who had comment they wanted to make sure they got in, get anything? Again, Mr. Shrewsbury, I don't think he's going to participate this evening. I don't think I missed him. I've been checking the lines pretty consistently. I think I've said *61 a number of times. Caller at 2730. Did you have commentary?
Hey, yeah, this is my first time calling in. I want to say hello to you and all of the guests. I wanted to make a quick comment since the guest didn't call in. You spoke earlier about the differences in the acknowledgments of victimization, right? So as a flooding victim, you can be acknowledged. But as a victim of racism, you can't be acknowledged. And I saw a continuity of that I live in the St. Louis area, the St. Louis region, and we lose black men here every day to gun violence. But I know a teacher of mine from my high school who, her husband was shot once, like on accident or something, about 7 months back. He didn't die. And the amount of outrage and empathy that you see surrounding people when they experience trauma, very eye-opening when you consider the amount of trauma that specifically young black males face here with the threat of death in this region. So I just wanted to make that comment and just put it out there. Appreciate everybody for listening.
Right on. First time caller. Glad you were able to dial in. That I agree with wholeheartedly. Have seen that as well, where there just is not as much sympathy. And I even felt that as well as a victim of white supremacy and a flood victim, where it was a sense from multiple people of you're trying to use this situation to get over on us because the city has already admitted liability, as they should. You're trying to get over on us for some sort of settlement. Like, yes, this was my mastermind to flood my residence so that I would not have a place to stay for God knows how long. Yes, that was my plan, or our plan in all of this. And even not listeners, but other folks just saying, you know, you are, I guess, taking advantage of the situation where you're trying to make it a bigger deal than it is and saying that it's traumatizing. Just whereas a black person, where you can be mistreated, traumatized, terrorized, and we're just somehow there is a lack of empathy for you, regardless of what you have experienced, what you have endured. There's just not a level of empathy for you, for black people. Absolutely. And that part of the experience as well. And I think that also can compromise self-care, because sometimes self-care might mean I need to take time for me. That's what we were talking about the last time we broadcasted with black maternal mortality rates and talking about bed rest for black mothers during pregnancy or after pregnancy, because of that is a traumatizing experience, giving birth, and saying that a lot of times black mothers, they get that same sort of stigma of, you know, you're lazy and you just don't want to work and you don't want to do anything. No, I've been giving birth and, you know, my body is just under assault with this whole process and changing and what have you. And even after the childbirth and that same sort of lack of empathy, absence, consistent within the system of white supremacy. I think I did actually get Mr. Shrewsbury's number. I'm going to see if we can ring him and dial him in for the program. I had my email up and had been pressing for an update, but he sent me his contact number, so I'm going to see if we can dial him and do the broadcast. So hang on one moment. We'll ring Mr. Shrewsbury and see if we can continue with that portion of the broadcast. Give me 30 seconds to dial Mr. Shrewsbury. Context of white supremacy. We will be right back.
Hello, this is Randy.
Greetings, Mr. Shrewsbury.
Yes.
Greetings. This is Gus calling in for the radio broadcast. Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Greetings. I did not get your email until a few seconds ago. I had my email up. I was hitting the refresh button, but for whatever reason, your response email didn't come through until just now. But we got you.
Nope.
Great. We are live on the air for listeners. Again, the Cows, Gus T. Renegade. We now have our guest with us. All the newfangled technology may have failed us with a bogged down email, but I think we have our guest joining us live. I'd mentioned Norm Stamper, what seems like an eternity ago, but he's sure been with us on the program many times before, former chief of the Seattle Police Department, carried a badge and a firearm for about 30 years here in Washington State and in California. Reminded me a lot of our guest for today's broadcast. Seems he's familiar with him. Our guest, he is a former enforcement official, former certified fire and explosion investigator and forensic investigator. He is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform. Joining us live, Mr. Randy Shrewsberry. Mr. Shrewsberry, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yes, sir. For our guests, I'm sure this is for some of our listeners, this is their first time hearing about you. Anything that you think would be important for our listeners to know about who you are, the work that you do?
Well, where I am today is a direct result of about 30 years of experience in criminal justice. I started out as a police officer and worked in three different states, and I had become an investigator, but took most of my training from there about 13 years after policing and went into the private sector and worked in that for about another 12 years, and then it's been a couple of, about a year and a half now, we have been working with the Institute. I had recognized that there was a training disparity and thought that this was an area of reform that wasn't being addressed.
All right, and folks can look online, the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform. They have a website. They explain more of the details about their mission. They have who's on the board and what have you. You can see photographs of Mr. Shrewsberry as well. Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform. I think one of our listeners, supporters, investors, Mr. Fox, he's been on the program numerous times over the years now. He's in the UK. He read Mr. Shrewsberry's article in the Huffington Post, I Was a Racist Cop. I think that got a lot of traction when he talked about some of his years on the force. Before we get into that and what's motivating your current activist work, before we get started, number one, racial classifications always important. You, Mr. Shrewsberry, are you a white man?
I am. I'm actually Native American, but my old man joke is I'm viewed as a white guy with a good tan. Certainly, I would be identified as white more than anything else.
Okay. I read your I think when I read the article on the Huffington Post, I'm not sure if there was a photograph there. I think I saw your photograph a little bit after I saw the article. So I was reading, yeah. I Was a Racist Cop. And then I saw the photograph after I'd read that and maybe even a few of your other articles. And then I saw the photograph and I said, I am not sure if this is a white person. Are there times?
I get that quite a bit. And living in Los Angeles, I'm confused often as being Latino. So I'll have folks just come up and begin fluently speaking Spanish, which I don't. I've been confused for Middle Eastern or Latino or mixed black and white. But I think largely. I think most would probably say I'm a white guy.
You grew up in Ohio, is that correct?
I did. I grew up in a rural part of the greater Cincinnati area, so probably kind of like the last suburb before it just gets to cornfields is where I grew up.
Okay. The former House Speaker, Republican John Boehner, he used to, or maybe he still does, but I know when he was in office, he used to get a lot of abuse and wisecracks about his complexion. People saying that he had like a permanent tan. People don't know who
yes.
former speaker, House Speaker John Boehner is. You can just, you know, Google his name. But when I saw your photograph, that's what it reminded me of instantly. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing's work as well. But I was pretty sure that there are probably a lot of times where other individuals who are classified, accepted as white, they question your racial classification, maybe even question whether or not you are a white man. Is that the case?
No, I wouldn't necessarily agree. I mean, I think that there are those that may confuse, you know, like in the example I gave where someone may come up and speak to me and start speaking Spanish. But I think that, you know, for me, my skin tone, my hair, that type of thing, I have facial hair, that really just kind of leaves people, just going back to the default of white, if that makes sense. Certainly, as a when I was a police officer, there was never a time that someone said, I don't think I ever remember a time that I wasn't described other than a white guy.
Okay. So you feel in your experience you have pretty consistently been accepted as a white man, pretty much without question?
Yeah, I think so. Certainly professionally and as well as personally. I think, again, it's, you know, there might be some confusion, you know, amongst a stranger or something, but that's about all. I would say largely I have been viewed and treated like a white guy all my life.
Have you ever, either your time serving as an enforcement official or in any other capacity, have you ever felt compelled to authenticate or prove your whiteness, your status as a white man, to other white people?
Oh, no, not at all. No, it's funny because I am mindful of the idea that I could be confused, especially as a Latino living in Los Angeles, and that makes me, it places me in a position that I am mindful of that at a first glance someone may think that I'm Latino, and then understanding interactions with how much more dangerous it is for a Latino man or any person of color, really, having an interaction with police. I'm kind of mindful of that. In fact, I parked my car a block or two away from my office, and I was walking in one day and needed to bring a little knife with me just to cut a wire or something that was in my office. And I recall when I got out of the car, thinking, it was just a little steak knife, and I was thinking, about what reaction that the police, if a police officer saw me, carrying it, and I kind of felt like, it's kind of on the edge. So I think I have a greater, some may confuse me as being a person of color, or some may just, again, think I'm a guy with a tan. But that being said, I don't know of any time that, I was stopped or I was treated in a way that, is consistent for what I saw and how Latinos and other people of color are treated. I think it's more of a situation where I'm probably a bit more mindful of it.
This program, we ask our guests, or I make sure I share my definition of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
I do. I think that, at least as it was for my experience, is that while doing that, while being racist, is that there's sometimes a conscious intent and sometimes there isn't. And that isn't a scapegoat. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's that we have a responsibility to be aware of that our actions, or as it related to the op-ed that I wrote, just my mere inactions, it's still racism. Whether or not, and again, this is my view, whether or not, I was malicious in thought, it isn't necessarily the point for me. I think that is an element. So, what I've said before is that we have a lot of blind racists walking around and just don't realize that they're racist. And I also think, that it's important to differentiate what is racist and what is bias. And I think that there is a separation there, too, which probably speaks a lot to intent.
For our listeners, first, I did not mention the word conscious in the definition when I spoke. That's one.
Sure.
For two, or the word bias. Those are two very important terms that I do not use when we are having dialogue about white supremacy, racism. I didn't use either of those terms. Also, metaphors. I know it's been a while since we've been broadcasting, but metaphors, that's something we've been talking about for a long time. Blind racists. Wow, that is quite a metaphor. Quite. I've never heard that one before. I'll have to think about that one, but it does seem to fit a pattern with regards to when I hear people talking about racism, white supremacy, specifically when I hear people talking about white culpability and white men and women like Mr. Shrewsbury practicing racism, white supremacy. When you brought in the terms, you introduced the terms conscious and unconscious when responding to the definition of my definition of white supremacy, racism. And you talked about some of the times you acknowledge your own unconscious acts of racism, sometimes silence when racist acts were happening around you. Can you think of any time where you have consciously practiced racism, white supremacy?
Oh, well, yes, for sure. I mean, you know, when I was a child, old enough to know better, I would say. So, you know, I'm not talking about when I was three or four, but it began at that very young age. I grew up in a atrociously racist home. And so much of what I heard and what I was taught there, in fact, I share that the only thing that I was taught as a child about Martin Luther King, it was that he was an instigator, that he would go city to city. These are the kind of, you know, to rile people up is what I remember my mother telling me. And, you know, I, even at a young age, was going, well, I'd be pretty riled up, too. Though I differed in the extremism that my parents had and my family, or, you know, that my family as a whole had, or has some of them, I said, you know, that certainly continued as I get older. And I can't say that I remember, you know, a specific incident, you know, pointing, looking at somebody and using the N-word or something like that. But I know that I've used it for certain. One of the things that I talk about in my op-ed is that where there is this kind of process of dehumanization. And so when, you know, there came a certain time and, you know, in policing in which, you know, I had stripped myself of any empathy. There was, you know, no self-reflection whatsoever. And the other side, so to speak, of what was going on, why, you know, why are there problems in particular communities? Why does the data say that some people, you know, have higher rates of criminality and that sort of thing, which I know now, you know, these are just skewed data. But at the time, you know, this is what I was taught. This is things I just kind of bought into. And then, so if you connect that, you know, with a Midwestern upbringing, you know, in a city or in a town in which I think we had, you know, one or two black people total, you know, that I went to school with as an example, it wasn't a far leap. I would say that the most direct means in which I targeted people was through through racial profiling. And in fact, in one of the states I worked at down in South Carolina, I was even named on a team when it was a little bit more widely accepted. It still goes on today, but it's typically hidden under different guys. But I mean, there were absolutely times that I would just sit in a neighborhood and wait for a black person to come through, and the moment they did, then, you know, that meant that they were up to something, and we would stop them, you know, harass them, run their, you know, their tags, search their car, that sort of thing. So there's a great deal of that. One of the things that I want to say is that I speak about some of the reasons that I acted the way that I did or the attitudes that I may have had, but it's very, very important for me to say that that this is not, you know, me seeking atonement. I absolutely believe that I had a responsibility of, you know, at the moment that I had, you know, developed critical thinking skills to understand that, you know, much of what I was saying and doing was damaging. So that's, you know, absolutely not a, you know, I'm not looking for cover. But I used to tell my son, there's excuse, you know, there may not be an excuse, but there is a reason. And so I think that by sharing some of those reasons is that it may help other people identify what they may have believed, you know, wasn't an act of racism, to really kind of step back and say, let's really look at this at the core. And I'll tell you, you know, this is something that I do on a daily basis. This isn't ending. I mean, there's things in the last weeks, you know, that stories that I may have told, and I never believed in a million years that what I was doing was racist. But when I really stripped down and asked myself questions like, okay, what if that had been a white person? Would I have acted differently? You know, or would I have been as afraid, or would I have been as harsh? And if you're honest with yourself, especially if you're in a position of power, as I was as a police officer, then it's hard to escape the reality that that, and this is where I use the term blind racism, of where we're just all kind of, and you know, very varying degrees, walking around doing things that that we're not being mindful of what the impact, the bigger impact is, or how that can subjugate, you know, people as a whole.
Right. I want to just make sure, I had a question, but I just want to make sure I heard you correctly. You said that you grew up in an atrociously racist household where they had racist ideas about black people that were on TV or what have you, even though they seemed that there were not very many black people in your hometown. You said you yourself have called black people nigger, maybe not to their face, but you've used the term, yes?
Sure. Yes.
You said that you practiced racism in your capacity as an enforcement official. You were, you know, in places where, oh, there goes a black person. Boop, I'm going to profile him, you know, go stop him, whatever that entails in your process as an enforcement official, race soldier, in my opinion. You said that it was one part I think I missed. You said that there was, I guess, a town where this is right in the part where you were talking about as an enforcement official, you would stop a black person if you saw one. You said that there were some towns or places where the team's mascot was something associated with racism. I didn't really understand that part. Do you?
Oh no, I'm sorry. I must have misspoke. No, I was saying that you know, there are areas in which, as a police officer, that we would create profiling teams, and so that its sole purpose would be, you know, looking like at that time, during that time, you know, there was a lot of awareness about drugs running from Miami to New York. I was in the Southeast, and so, you know, we would literally sit on 995 and look for young black people or young Latinos. If they happened to be in a rented car, that only ensured that they would absolutely get stopped. And then there was no other basis other than that, just it's a black guy. Now,
if I could hop in right there, and I think this is extremely important. This is a pattern that we've observed for years. And in my view, I've said also metaphors. When I hear a white person who, as you've just done, who testifies, admits numerous conscious acts of racism over a number of years from extraordinary positions of power as an enforcement official, where you literally, you not just have the ability to cage someone, take away their liberties, you can take away their life, operating with a pistol, where you've admitted these things and said that you had a team. I'm glad you cleared that up, because maybe I just didn't hear that part correctly. But you said you had teams that were specifically designed, profiling teams, to go out and nabbing black people, nabbing niggers. We see them, we're going to profile them, we got this drug, whatever, that's going to be the ruse. We got a drug pipeline that we're stopping, but we're stopping black people. To use the term blind racist, in my view, that is one of the gargantuan, and I want to highlight, emphasize, we have been here for a while, that is one of the gargantuan ways that white people practice white supremacy racism. It is a very different conversation to just say, these are what I said in my definition. This is white dedication. These are deliberate acts to maintain white power, deliberate acts to terrorize black people, not blind racists. This is not something new in terms of white people. You talk about this. I've heard you give interviews. White people having these sorts of profiling teams. That's not new in the annals of the ACC. You already know. If you're continuing to do something over a number of years, decades, centuries even, because I've heard you talk where you say this problem is directly connected with the enslavement of black people in this area of the world. If that's true, it's farcical. In my view, it's more than farcical. It is an act of white supremacy to term this blind racism as though somehow whites are naive or unaware that they keep doing these things. Your response?
I think that's a really, really great point, except I disagree, is that, if I may back up for just a little bit, and again, this is not of any defense of me as an individual, but and it certainly isn't a just a blanket pardon of the behavior. But this is what I will say, is that in policing specifically, there is a great deal of attitudes and beliefs about evil and, you know, good versus evil, that sort of thing. If you go into work every single day and your job day in and day out is typically arresting black people, that's the areas that your supervisors are sending to you that from the training academies, that's the pictures, that's the imagery that, you know, is just shown to you over and over and over and over. I always say that in the academy, that training became where black guy and bad guy became synonymous. But it's not a conscious transition. It's just something that you're seeing day in and day out. Because that you spend your time policing, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions about policing, but one of them that is probably one of the biggest is that it's not an exciting job. It's an incredibly boring job. There's a lot of idle time. There's a lot of downtime.
Mr. Shrewsbury, I just wanted to hop in really quick because I wanted to get a question. Sure. And if this is just because it's not to interrupt you to disparage your response or what have you. It's just it's been my experience a lot of times in these exchanges with whites. A lot of times they will talk and talk and talk, but they won't really answer your question. And this is one I want to try to get to as efficiently as possible. This is one I also want our listeners to remember Norm Stamper when we're talking about whether or not this is being done with, you know, awareness. Are whites conscious? Are they just stumbling along? Norm Stamper's anecdote where his training officer, supervising officer, told him, go in there and get the black fella. Don't forget your nigger knocker. That, yep, to me, does not sound like someone who is unaware or ignorant about racism, white supremacy, and what they are doing with their instructions for the nigger knocker. My question, Mr. Shrewsbury, is can you explain how it would be logically accurate to refer to what whites are doing, if you want to talk specifically about policing and specifically targeting to arrest, jail, all sorts of criminal acts against black citizens, how it would be logically accurate to term that blind racism? Can you explain that?
I think that I don't know that I can satisfactorily. What I would say is that this is more about ingrained thinking than it is the consciousness of, I'm going to go find a black person to mess with.
But that's what he said. That's what he said. I'm going to go find a black person to mess with. He told him specifically, just go find a black person and get your nigger knocker. That's exactly what Norm Stamper said. And you responded as though that's not, you know, an anomalous thing where police are specifically saying we're just looking for a black person to mess with. And in fact, I'm going to pause right here because I do have other questions, so I want to try and cover as much ground as I can. But I do want – the main thing I want to emphasize is before you got into all that, you said no. You could not provide a logical explanation to say, yes, it would be accurate based on logic to describe this as blind racism. You said no. I don't think you can either, and I'll repeat what I said before. For Mr. Shrewsbury or any other white person to describe this as blind racism – they're practicing white supremacy, and in my view, they're trying to give you something that doesn't make sense. They're trying to give you an illogical way of framing this problem that does not just make it very simple and very honest and accurate. White dedication to terrorizing black people, maintenance of white supremacy. That's what it is. Use terms that reflect that.
What I'm saying to you is that I am not disagreeing whatsoever with your description. And certainly, I mean, there were things, I mean, I can't tell you the number of times in which I heard, you know, supervisors even, or someone at a shift change or a roll call say, let's go F with some N-words. I heard that more times than I could count. Did that have an impact on me and my behavior? Absolutely, without a question. I don't doubt it. Did I feel it at that moment? No, because at that moment I rejected it, and I was,
I didn't even ask about you personally. That is interesting. I have to think about that, especially since you acknowledged that you grew up in an atrociously racist household.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Hang on 1 second. I'm just asking listeners to just think about that, because I had a totally different question. But since you volunteered that, even just think about that. Mr. Shrewsbury saying that he, at that time, didn't think it impacted him, these racist jokes and what they were saying about black people, niggers.
Mm-hmm.
But you grew up in an atrociously racist household. It's not like this is foreign to you, these concepts. It would have to be pretty familiar if you grew up and your family is talking about niggers in this manner. But my question, you grew up in Ohio. You lived and practiced policing law in South Carolina. In fact, in 1995, you were by the South Carolina Rotary Club. You were Officer of the Year. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. And I worked as a cop in Ohio and then also in Indiana. So there's 3 states total that I worked in.
Yes, sir. In South Carolina, recognition to Walter Scott and Reverend Clementa Pinckney, Charleston 9.
Yeah.
You were in Charleston, in fact, not just South Carolina, mm-hmm. Charleston specifically.
Right outside of Charleston, yeah.
Right outside. Okay. What do you think you did to warrant Office of the Year in 1995?
I arrested a lot of people. That was it. I was a night shift officer. In fact, I was a supervisor, and for that particular year, I spent a great deal of time doing DUI enforcement. So I had, I think it was like 90 or 100 arrests total, which was either the first or the second highest in the state of all officers. So it was about this kind of productivity. And this is what I was speaking about with earlier, is where there's, you know, there's a pressure from, you know, from the administration. They don't call them quotas, but they're quotas. You know, they call it productivity, for which you need to, you know, have a, you know, certain number of arrests and certain number of tickets. Well, where would you go? You would go to, you know, to the poorest areas, you know, that's the effing with N-words. That's exactly what it was. And I want to make a point that about my comment about, I'm afraid my comment about being blindly racist, for some clarification, is number one is that there is of no question that my behavior, me specifically, was racist, even when I wasn't using the N-word. It was racist every time that I heard someone else using the N-word and didn't say anything, whether it was in the most casualist of forms or, you know, in something just, you know, really, really atrocious. So, I'm not looking to absolve myself from there. The other thing that to mention is, you know, coming from the home that I came from and rejecting largely, and you know, this went through tears over the years. I didn't reject it as much as I should have when I was younger, and probably still, you know, continue today, still have more reasons, more things to examine to continue. But I was a little bit to the left, you know, so if you think about cops, most of them are pretty conservative, you know, the Chicago Police Union, you know, endorsed Trump, so did the, you know, Border Patrol. These are pretty, pretty conservative people. So what I incorrectly did was measure my racism based on how much more racist somebody else was. And so that always placed me in a position where I could comfortably say, oh, I'm not being racist. What I'm saying to you, and that's the blind racism for me. That was that circumstance for me, is that I dismissed it. In fact, one of the things I would always say is that the true target was always poor people more than it was black people. Now, as I grew, as I learned more, as I studied, I realized that, yes, if you're in a town where there's only white people, as I did in Ohio, I mean, not only white people, but probably maybe a tenth of a percent of people of color, it would be the trailer parks that we were targeting. It would be the low-income neighborhoods that we were targeting. But that doesn't mean that I wasn't racist. That doesn't mean that I wasn't, you know, if a black person drove through the town, that wouldn't improperly, you know, trigger my my interest. Not at all. What I'm saying when I say blindly is that there's two separate sets of behaviors that are not tied together, and that's for me, that's what I missed.
Okay. When I've also heard you speak before about your time and talking about some of the differences in policing, you talked about some of the different regions that you've been an enforcement official. You said in the South, the racism was more open. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's better or worse than what you would experience in the North, just more open. And you talk about some of the racist jokes that you heard in your time as an enforcement official. That is something that for years, our 9-year anniversary is next month. For years, we have talked about the importance of racist jokes. That's something that I've emphasized. Always love it when we have white guests who, you know, talk about being a part of these exchanges. Are there any racist jokes that you recall hearing from your days as an enforcement officer that you can share with us?
Well, I think the one that jolted me the most was in the South, and there was this constant poking about being a Yankee. I was surprised, you know, that the Civil War was still going on, but they were still talking about who was a Yankee and who wasn't. I was outside of a department. There was probably 20 of us standing outside. It was probably shift change or something, maybe after a training, and one of the officers yelled across, hey, Shrewsbury, do you know why we hate Yankees? And I said, no, why? And he said, it's because y'all think black people are people, too, but he said N-word. And I was just utterly stunned. I mean, my mouth dropped open. But where I was racist, my culpability is I just laughed along. I said nothing. I made no objections. I knew of police officers who would describe black people as fallen angels. You know, the religiously fanatic, saying that black people were a defect from God. But the problem is that I didn't say that, but I did not consider my responsibility, which was more of my privilege, more deep down racist views. I didn't feel the responsibility at that time to speak out against it. It was just accepted.
Hmm. Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Mr. Randy Shrewsbury. If you have a question you would like to ask, feel free to chime in. The number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate.
Number again, 641-715-3640, code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you dialed in before, for some of the folks who called in early and shared a comment or two, I guess we'll already have a hand up. That might be a little confusing, but we will work it out. Just *61 if you have a question for Mr. Shrewsberry. We will get you on the line. Again, our guest, Mr. Shrewsberry, you are the founder, executive director of the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform. As you said before, this nonprofit has not been around that long, just about a year and a half or so. What is your ultimate purpose, your ultimate goal with this nonprofit?
Well, foremost is that we need to realign in the means in which police are just simply trained from the from kind of top to bottom. Slave patrols was the original purpose of policing, and when training academies became introduced, it was still based on that kind of foundation, even though slavery in the legal sense had passed. And it hasn't been changed since. The only major change that police training's ever had was in the late 50s, early 60s, when Daryl Gates moved and started presenting militarized policing through SWAT forces and that sort of stuff. There's some really major issues within police training that most folks don't know about. First and foremost, is about half of the U.S. has exceptions that allow police officers to work on average a year. Some is a little bit more, some's a few of them are a little bit less, but work for about a year without ever going to training. So like the first year they work as a cop, full powers, they kill you, they can arrest you, they ruin, entire communities really, without it ever attending basic training. Hawaii doesn't have any training requirements at all. The states altogether, when we look at training as a whole, officers are only receiving on average about 800 hours of training. They're mandated a little bit less, but they're getting about 800 hours of training. So that turns into about a semester and a half of college is all the training that they're having. And then there's issues like with junk science, that they rely on methods not only to arrest people. Like, so as an example, I was a fire investigator, which was a two-week school for me to become an expert, which is ridiculous. I wasn't an expert. Engineers are experts, or PhDs are experts. But I was treated as one. I was able, to testify as one based on this very limited training, and it was also wrong training, is that we've since learned that, there's a kind of a science denialism in policing and criminal justice, in which we're not listening to scientists saying that, as an example, with fires, the methods in which, we would determine, like, if something was an arson or how a fire started was incorrect. The other big issues are, as it relates to our topic here, is that, indigenous people are five times as likely than whites to be killed by the police. African Americans are three times, and Latinos are twice. And so while there are some mixed solutions, we really believe that everything is kind of at the basis of most of what officers do is a direct result of their training. So we want them to get more training, less militarized training, more specific training about criminality, about behavior, about bias, about self-care, mental health, those kinds of things, and a lot less focus on issues like the terrible drug war, or stopping people for taillights out, that sort of thing.
Okay. And I know you said this is a relatively new organization, nonprofit. What's the annual operating budget that you all are currently working with?
So we're under 100,000 right now. We formed the team, kind of got together in the fall of 2016. Today, actually, is our 1 year anniversary of receiving our 501c3. We've spent this past year in development mode. One of the things that we recognized is that the approach in which any kind of reform typically happens is done so very two-dimensionally. It's really kind of only coming from the law enforcement's perspective without asking the community the very simple question of how will this impact you? Because we are wanting to kind of do a, you know, from a ground-up perspective, our foundation as an organization has 25 groups, community groups that are represented to make sure that not only is it the police officers that you know, are ensuring their safety, because you know, I think everybody wants other fellow humans to be safe regardless of their profession. However, instead of the current models in which, you know, there's, forgive the term, but, you know, it's more of a token seat at the table where, you know, there might be one person from the, you know, from the community that gets to be able to speak, and they're usually handpicked by very pro-law enforcement organizations or the unions, those types of things. We came at this approach and said that the only way that we can do this is, number one, is to have a full understanding of what the problems are from the community's perspective, and then allow them to weigh in on what possible solutions that there are. So as an example, where, you know, civilian review boards, that sort of thing that, you know, a lot of police departments have that are typically pretty ineffective, you know, those are usually made up with 90% police officers or pro-criminal justice, and then there's one or two from a community. We do this as one seat at the table for everyone, including law enforcement. Of course, that they should weigh in, but their life and training to protect their life is no less valuable than, or no more valuable, I'm sorry, than protecting the lives of every citizen. So that's what we work to make sure that we ensure.
Okay. Now I'm thinking about that. I'm processing that, and I'm thinking of other incidents. Like, are you familiar with Daniel Holtzclaw? Is that name familiar to you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you give us some info if you know who he is?
Danny Holtzclaw. He was in Arizona, I believe. Is that the case that you're talking about? He was a homeless individual.
No. Daniel Holtzclaw.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. Daniel Holtzclaw, he was an enforcement official in Oklahoma City. In 2015, he was arrested, and about a little over a year later, he was convicted right about the end.
Oh, yeah.
You are familiar? He was convicted of mass rapes.
Sexual assault. Yes. Yeah, rape.
Okay.
Yes. Which there's a huge issue in, that exists in law enforcement with sex crimes, the criminality of police officers, which is another issue that a lot of folks don't talk about.
Absolutely, one that we have devoted quite a bit of time talking about on this broadcast, the Daniel Holtzclaw case specifically, and as you mentioned, the broader problem of sexual terrorism from enforcement officials. Are you familiar with Justin Volpe? Is that name familiar? Justin Volpe?
No.
Okay. Justin Volpe, he was an enforcement officer in New York City. He anally sodomized Abner Louima, a black male immigrant, sodomized him with a plunger and then paraded around the police station with the plunger, proud of what he did. He was ultimately convicted. And Holtzclaw's case is up for appeal. That is one that folks should continue to keep an eye on. But I think I brought up those two cases specifically just because I asked about the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform, what you all's objective is, what you're hoping to do. And you said kind of the core of this, and I've read, you know, some of your other interviews and what have you, where you talk about training and how people can be a cosmetologist, and you are required to do more training than an enforcement officer in many states, not all, but in many states. Oh, there you go. All states, where it's just very little training, and this needs to be corrected. And I'm not disagreeing the training could be improved, but if we're talking about the problem of racism, white supremacy, if we're talking about that problem,
I don't think that's an issue of training at all. I don't think the problem with Daniel Holtzclaw was that he was poorly trained. I don't think the problem with Justin Volpe was that he was poorly trained. I don't think training is something that will correct someone that, oh, yes, do not insert plunger in the rectum of black male. That's not a training issue. That is a dedicated to the system of white supremacy. And this sort of thing is what the entire tradition of policing in this area of the world, that is an enormous aspect of what this has been all about, not for decades, but for centuries in this part of the world. That's what this was established to do. That is a totally different conversation. And again, in my view, that is not a training issue. Your response?
So I have two points to make. One is that if there are things that are, you know, genuinely working, which is very little, by the way, in my view, but those things that are genuinely working, we hope to improve those. However, from our standpoint, is there's just so much wrong, and the approach that we're, you know, not only the number of hours, but the approach in which they're taught, who's teaching them, how often they need to be retrained, what steps or, you know, what mechanisms are in place to weed out bad officers once, you know, they've already gone through training. However, my second point is that, you know, as it relates directly to Holtzclaw, is that part of training and, you know, that we've kind of taken on is also recruitment. And so as an example, most police officers take a psychological examination called the MMPI that should be grabbing the attention of the, you know, the hiring folks or the psychologist to say that, you know, you're probably going to, you know, you're buying into someone who's got a lot of problems or propensity to this kind of violence, that type of thing. The MMPI and then the MMPI 2 has been used for years and years and years, but we still see criminality. We still see, you know, at a higher rates than even in other professions of, you know, positions of trust. You know, like if we compare to like judges and doctors, teachers, that sort of thing, we see a great deal more of criminality among police officers. And they're all pretty predictable. You know, there are domestic violence, battery, sexual assault, you know, so, you know, all crimes of violence, that's not being weeded out. And so if you have the numbers of cops that are arrested each year, you know, as we see, it's not working. So, that, you know, we say the same thing about training as a whole. If you kill four people a day and a cop's killed every 2 weeks, it's not working. So we have to have a brand new approach. And so that's what our ground up approach is. Now, I will say, without any intent to minimize or dismiss, is there's always going to be the Daniel Holtzclaws of the world. You know, there's always going to be, you know, these folks that are taking advantage of the position that they're in to be able to wield their power against someone, you know, more vulnerable. However, I do believe that it is critical that every agency reexamines in which what they're doing to screen this out, and that's what we believe has miserably failed. So would it have caught Daniel Holtzclaw specifically? I don't know, but I do believe that it would cut back on a lot of incidences of, you know, Holtzclaw. But and by the way, you know, I am looking at this at a surface level or more surface level. What is going on for which, you know, gave him this idea in which that he could do that once placed in that position? I think there's, you know, that is that, you know, white supremacy that you speak of that we have to address as well. The other kind of screening that we want too is about bias. Is that if someone has shows indications of greater bias, then that should be something that we're weeding out.
My response, the two important words in your response there, where you said the system
failed, where you're having incidents like these, whether it's failing and not screening out some of these individuals so that you don't have these incidents happening, you're not attracting individuals to want to be enforcement officials who might have a propensity for this sort of sexual abuse or racism or any other misdeeds that enforcement officials are carrying out. Alcoholism, certainly. I know some of our guests have talked about that, enforcement officials being under the influence in carrying out some of these deeds. I would say failed and not working, those would depend on what exactly these systems are supposed to be doing. If we are in a system of racism, white supremacy, and we're supposed to have profiling teams, and we're supposed to have enforcement officials who do feel, hey, any 10, 12, 13, because Daniel Holtzclaw, I think it was 13 victims that he went to trial for, any 13 niggers that you feel like raping while you're on duty or off duty or what have you, that's what you're supposed to do in the black part of town. If that's what this is about in the system of white supremacy, then it is working. It is not a failure. Well, hang on one second. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. And that comes back to why I said I reject terms, thinking about this, paradigms where it's blind racism. The conversation should be, are we in a system where this is the design? This is exactly what is supposed to be happening. This is exactly what's been happening for, again, decades, centuries in some cases. This is exactly what's supposed to be happening. This is a new year going right on into 2020, 2025. We'll be having the same conversation in 2100 if that's what is supposed to be happening. It's a very different way of thinking about this. And again, in my view, the people who are saying that this is blind racism or accidental in somehow, or white people are not aware, all of that is misleading you. And in my view, again, I'm just restating, when Mr. Shrewsbury or any other white person presents that way of thinking, that is an act of racism, white supremacy, because it's just not based on logic. Have you ever fired your service weapon in the line of duty, Mr. Shrewsbury? Did you ever?
No.
Okay.
Never.
Were you ever?
There had been times I could have, and I would have been perfectly cleared to, but there was no need for me to ever.
Were you ever, in your time as an enforcement official or as a forensic investigator, because you had other capacities, were you ever accused of practicing racism?
Pretty regularly, in fact. I think most cops are. This kind of goes to, and I understand that we disagree about blind racism, and I will absolutely examine this phrase as my days go forward. What I would say to you is that as a really good example is that there would be folks that I would pull over, who are black, my logic, what was going on in my head, is the belief in which black people are arrested at greater rates. There's something wrong with that community. There's a moral failing. Now, the evidence that I used to base that up is faulty, but that was the evidence that I knew at the time. But I would stop somebody, and they would say, I know the only reason why you're stopping me is because I'm black. And I would react, most of the time I wouldn't say anything, but I would, react in my mind that, no, I'm one of the good ones. There's some really racist guys out here, but that's not me. What I didn't do, what was my white privilege, is that I did not have to, I let myself off the hook of examining what is the legitimacy in somebody saying that, if for nothing else, even if it was just the appearance of it. Is it legitimate for a black person to assume that they're being a target of racist acts each time that they're stopped, even if it really wasn't? And I would say yes, they would. And that was what my privilege allowed me to separate myself from, is not giving the credence to ask myself, why is it that black people are saying this to me all the time? Is it because what I'm doing is racist, or is this the experience that they live? And it was both. Sometimes I stopped people because I was profiling them, but there were a lot of other times that I stopped somebody who believed that I was being racist when it was just, you know, just a stop that I would have made with anybody where I had no idea who was driving, as an example, or what the color of their skin was. But neither is wrong. What was wrong is that I created a, this barrier that created the blindness or continued that barrier, in which I did not look at exactly, I did not hear those accusations with legitimacy. But I do now. I mean, I see it now.
Two questions, and I'll double check with our callers, see if they have questions that they want to get in as well. We might have new listeners might be like, wow, Gus, you have a lot of suspicion questioning Mr. Shrewsberry. Do you think it's logical for any black person, any non-white person, victim of white supremacy to be suspicious of you or any other white person under the system of white supremacy?
Absolutely. I couldn't imagine you wouldn't. That's earned. Yeah. I think, so as an example, one of the things that I talk about that kind of goes with this is that I have this belief that as a whole, if we look at policing, there's no good cops and bad cops. What I always say is there's some cops that are better intended than others, but the behavior is the exact same. And because of that, then I think that if we set aside that motivations really doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, I mean, it matters perhaps to the individual, but at the end of the day, the reactions or the behavior is the same. Absolutely, of course. Knowing that, I think that if anyone is seriously talking about the problems in criminal justice and is not talking about the weight in which racism impacts our entire criminal justice system, then I think I think that they're being intellectually dishonest. Okay. However, that
hold
being
on one
said.
Second. Hold on one second. Well, my other quick question. And have you made any effort since you talked about your own experience in participating in these profiling teams and what have you? Have you made any effort at restitution to some of the black people that you may have stopped unjustly and, you know, caused real problems?
No, I left policing in the early 2000s. I would, you know, have no idea even in which that could be done. The answer is no. I have never.
No restitution.
I've never been. Pardon me.
Mr. Stamper said the same thing. We had him on the program. He had some similar incidents. One of my other favorite anecdotes, he said he would do the chokehold. This was when he was in San Diego. He said he would do the chokehold. And this is in his book, some of these anecdotes, Breaking Rank. Mm-hmm. He said he would do the chokehold on the suspect, and then he would whisper in their ear, "You're going to die, asshole," before they blacked out. But he also said he didn't do any restitution for the folks that he abused, assaulted while he was carrying a badge and a gun. For folks who dialed in, if you have a question for Mr. Shrewsberry, checking folks who have a hand up, if you have a question you would like to get in, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have a question. Looking at the switchboard, for some reason it's taking a while to load. I will see if I can refresh and nab some of the hands Okay, there it goes. Great, reload. All right, so folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, I'm going to try and go down the line. Hopefully I will not mess up with the people who dialed in who had a hand up earlier to just get their comments since we were back on the air. The caller... 5136, caller 5136. Did you have a question for Mr. Shrewsberry? You should be with us. Last four digits, 5136. Are you just listening or did you have a question?
Oh, yes, Jeff. Welcome back, big victim.
Greetings in Alabama.
Yes, Mr. Shrewsberry. I'm looking
Please call
at
me
you
Randy.
On Facebook. Yes, Randy. I'm looking at you on Facebook, and you look like and then I was listening to some of the callers when Gus was trying to get in contact with you, and they were saying he looked black. So I went back to Facebook and I looked at your picture for about a second time, and I looked and I said, "He do look black." Was you adopted?
No, I just come from an indigenous home. My grandparents, on both sides of my mother and father's side, was Cherokee Indian. So everyone in my family kind of looked that way. You were kind of asking earlier, Gus, about how, folks would identify. Like, I remember even as a child, my parents would say that if we were swimming, like, at a lake or a pool or something, they would be able to spot us because we were the people who were a little darker than white people, but lighter than black people. So, I could see where someone may say that. They just haven't said it to me. Latino more than anything else, but that might be because of, the part of the country I live in.
I got a second question, Gus. When you was a police officer, did you have any of your fellow police officers, like, they was kind of standoffish to you because, they looked at you because, you don't look white. You look like an Indian. So did you have any of your fellow police officers that was like the hardcore racist? Would some of the racist police officers be kind of standish off to you? Thank you for letting me ask the question.
As we're talking about it, I remember that there being instances, and so there was a running joke about whether or not I was Middle Eastern at one point. There were racist jokes relative, to whether or not I was Middle Eastern. I don't feel like that was ever the case. It certainly could have been. Where I saw a greater separation was because I was liberal. And so, as Mr. Hutchinson just talked about, Norm Stamper's quote of choking someone out, now, I'd seen it, but I never did it. Which is another part of, where I was measuring extremes of behavior as to whether or not, I was doing something wrong. But there was constantly, when I would insist on the times that I did, and this was later in the career, in my career, that, we don't just stop somebody and make them dump pockets out on the hood of your car and you make up probable cause after it happens. That's when there was distance that was started being created. When I left policing, I had done some consulting work on, like, criminal defense attorneys, that sort of stuff. They would label you a turncoat, because they're, it's a mortal sin to speak out, to not stay with the boys in blue, that sort of thing. So if there was a separation that I saw, and in any large way I would say that I didn't really feel it in any meaningful way, I mean, I did notice that, I just was had far more liberal thinking about ideals than the cops that I worked with then.
Okay. Appreciate that, Big Victim. Caller, last four digits, 8179. 8179. If you had questions for Mr. Shrewsbury, you should be with us.
May I be heard?
Greetings. Caller in Michigan, good to hear from you.
Greetings and welcome back, Gus. just had one question for the guest. Who do you feel is most confused? Or more confused about racism, white supremacy, in your experience, white people or non-white people, and why?
Well, unequivocally, white people. And, you know, this is the very purpose. I'm going to assume that most of the folks that may be listening to this who are African American, there's not going to be a lot that I'm going to say that's going to be very shocking to anybody. I can have this exact same conversation, or for those Caucasians that may be listening, a lot of this may be new. This is new information. I think, and I appreciate, Mr. Hutcherson, your challenge to what I'm saying is, and making sure that I'm not being a part of that, is that there is a fundamental denialism, number one, about racism, especially in the criminal justice system and how it impacts communities of color. But at the same time, there is also a level of of racism in which liberal white folks will believe that they are woke, so to speak, but at the same time they're cheering on cheering on policies that extend the drug war, or mass incarceration, or the continuance of targeting of police, or the squashing of criticism of the police, because that's an issue as well, is that, you know, we have this kind of romanticized view of the police, and they have used that as a weapon in which they push back. I say that, you know, like for us as an organization, when we talk about those that we want to inform the most, tends to be folks who showed up the Women's March, white middle-aged women that that voted for Trump. It was white women that pushed him over that edge. Who has an awareness of that about the racism, however, are passively just accepting it. And those are the folks that that we're most trying to reach. And at least on a smaller scale, we're one by one, voice to voice, that's what we're hoping to achieve.
Sir, Gus, can I ask one more question just based off of his response?
Proceed.
You said that you were raised in a racist, a very racist household. Is that correct?
Yes, it was. Yes.
Would you say you were confused growing up about racism, white supremacy, how it worked, and just what it is?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Because a couple of things. Is one is to understand my public education. There was nothing about the civil rights movement. We didn't learn anything about it. If it was brought up, it wasn't in any meaningful way. We were only taught, Malcolm X was a terrorist, the Black Panthers was a terrorist organization, much of the same language that we're seeing again now with Black Lives Matter. So as a young child, I didn't have a lot of reason to reject what my teachers were telling me. However, I was at a pretty young age when I started rejecting in degrees of what my parents were telling me. So as an example, my father once said, "Black people are okay, just don't eat with them and don't sleep with them." The moment that he said that, and I was probably 11 or 12 years old, I rejected that. I thought that was ridiculous. When I was told that Martin Luther King was just an instigator, I thought, even as a child, I thought to myself, there's a reason to be instigating. I'd be riled up too if I was being treated this way. What I didn't understand is the tentacles of racism. I didn't understand how far-reaching it is. I didn't understand the historical context, still much of which I'm learning today. Embarrassingly, it was just a few months back that I learned about sharecropping. I didn't know about it. It just had never been taught, and I had not dedicated myself to learn at an earlier age. And so, I would say, and again, you know, if when measuring, if there was worse, you know, I was, I was the golden child as it relates to race in my family. But that certainly isn't the measurement. You know, that's not the success measurement. That just means I was less crappy than somebody else's views.
Okay, well, thanks for answering my questions. I'm going to mute myself. And again, welcome back, Gus.
Much obliged. Thank you kindly for a standard question. Much appreciated. Other folks, let's see. Imhandisi, dialed in. You had a question for Mr. Shrewsbury. You should be with us. Did you have a question, sir?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. My question to the individual is, one, you said that you classify as white. Is that correct?
I do, yeah.
Yes. So, okay. So, do you understand scientifically that you are albino or albinoid?
I did not know that, no.
Okay. The other question, my last question is, are you going to, or what are you going to do to end the system of white supremacy in the next 2 months?
Well, what steps am I going to take to be a part of that?
That's not what I asked. My question is, what are you going to do to have the system of white supremacy ended in 2 months?
Oh, well, I can't.
Why can't you?
Why can't I end all white supremacy?
Yes.
There's a much greater ingrained issue throughout our population. I mean, there's not, I wish that there was something that I could do or say that would absolve it. But I would be being dishonest to say that I could be.
But you are a white person.
Mm-hmm. I am. So what
I
can do
is white
people
are causing white. White people are doing white supremacy. White people are the ones that are committing the crime of white supremacy. White supremacy is killing black people. You are a white person. Why can you not finish this system, end this system, in 2 months' time?
Well, because I don't think that there's one individual anywhere that can reverse what everyone else is doing or what everyone else's attitudes are.
How long will it take for you to leave this country?
Well, I'm trying today. This is how I am working to do it. I just have no illusions that it's going to happen fast, and I don't know that it's going to ever happen. I'm going on 50 years old. I don't know that it's ever going to happen in my lifetime. There's no evidence that it's going to reverse that much over the next 30 or 40 years.
You'll continue white supremacy for the rest of your life. That's my final question.
I'm going to continue combating white supremacy, and that's the position that I am in now. And how I do that, one is through the nonprofit organization where we're targeting, but in a greater sense, as a human, is to talk openly, allow my conceptions to be challenged, allow there to be a dialogue that should have happened 30 years ago, for me personally, and I built from there. That's the furthest that I can do. I speak about it every day. I write about it. I do media events and that sort of thing. I encourage other white people to step outside of denialism, to look what evidence tells us, even if they don't know someone who has shared their personal stories of threats from police or treatment in the courts or that sort of thing, as I show them what the evidence is. Not that that should be needed. I mean, we should just be listening. But those are the steps that I can take to work towards chiseling this down. But the reality is that this country was built on the back of black and brown people, its very beginnings, we can start with the genocide of the indigenous people and slavery. White people have profited and have climbed ladders on the backs of black folks for decades and decades and decades. That's what, you know, while we're better today than we were yesterday in some areas, we have just so much more to overcome. I wish it could be done in a couple of months. I can only give you what my pledge is as a human being, is that I speak about it and confront about it, challenge my own self as much as possible to make sure that it's not a continuation of behavior. It's not this blindness that I mentioned.
Appreciate that, Mhandisi. See Thomas in New York. Did you have a question for Mr. Shrewsbury, or are you just listening? You just listening, or did you have a question, Thomas in New York? Assume he's just listening. Just checking in to make sure I'm not missing any hands. Black female caller in New York, did you have a question for Mr. Shrewsbury? Are you just listening? Folks might be just listening. That's fine, too. Caller at 2730, are you just listening, or did you have a question?
Yes, I have one question for Randy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You mentioned how blacks were associated with crime during your time in police training and as an officer. Could you speak more to how blacks were framed as criminals, and specifically any other words or terminology that they were referenced to?
Absolutely, sir. One of the easiest ways to point to the faulty data in this is that when we look at what are called UCR reports that the FBI does every year, so police departments are supposed to report particular statistics about arrests, violent crimes, that sort of stuff, including the demographics of those that are arrested. So if you look at a spreadsheet, it's going to say that proportionally black people are arrested at greater rates than white people. What is left out, the context that is left out in this, in training, in the day-to-day work, is what percentage of those folks are arrested as a result of targeting African Americans or other people of color or other vulnerable groups. So black people and white people use drugs at the exact same rate. Data, we know this. So if two people are smoking a joint, it's just 50-50 if it's going to be a white person or a black person. But a black person is three times more likely to be arrested. And the reason why is crime is where you look for it. If the police spent an equal amount of time in the suburbs or predominantly white areas and stopping every 17-year-old white kid that is walking down the street or driving down the road and shakes him down to see if he has weed, then the arrests are going to be equal. So the problem that we have is that we really just don't know. We know where the police's productivity is spent, quote-unquote productivity, and that is typically in minority communities. So if I spent all of my time stopping, as an example, only Asian women when they're driving, believing that, Asians don't drink and drive at higher rates, if all else is equal, I'm going to arrest more Asian people because that's who I'm stopping. And that's the crux of the faulty premise that's sold is that this is a part of this blindness that I was speaking of, Gus, is that believing in which, you can look at a spreadsheet and say, oh, yeah, black people are committing more crimes. And then, you know, I would spend day in and day out arresting black people without the consciousness of saying the reason why I'm arresting this person. I haven't questioned why we don't spend time, in the suburbs. Why are we not shaking down? That's the biggest example that I can explain. So that, you know, the data in which is pointing towards race classification, saying one is more criminal than the other, it's just a facade. We just don't know if it's even. It's just junk data. We just know that that's where the cops are. That's where they're making an arrest. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Caller at 3311. 3311, did you have a question for Mr. Shrewsbury?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi.
Hi. My question was actually, I live in Dayton, Ohio, Montgomery County, and right now there's like a pretty bad opioid crisis that's affecting our neighborhoods. And I was just curious, being a cop, you had stated earlier that in like the culture of your workplace, a lot of the reasons why you tended to profile and stop black people is because you were seeing them and viewing them more as criminals.
Yes.
So I was wondering if, with that same logic, would you say that now that there's a lot of cops who are having to revive these people who have been ODing on opioids and whatnot, do you think that over time they would start profiling and seeing white people as criminals, seeing how white people tend to be the main ones being revived? And that's my question.
Sure. So my answer is no, I don't think that they will. In fact, I think that we're already hearing language that is vastly different than what we were hearing during the crack epidemic, and that was kind of the height of my career. Most of my career was spent in the 1990s. So this came right after a big militarization push, and then the continuation of the war on drugs. It was where Clinton had given lots and lots of money for cops grants and that sort of stuff that made officers. Really, I mean, one of their most primary functions were in the drug war. I think that the opioid crisis actually highlights perfectly our racist approach into criminal justice when, we didn't hear politicians talking about issues of addiction, causes, what underlying factors could be causing. Is this about education? Is it about economic equality? Those types of things that we're hearing now. In fact, I read an article about the opioid crisis in West Virginia, and there was a litany of scientific reasons of why these communities are suffering it the way that they are. The problem is that they're closer to right in the way that they're handling this, as with the opiate crisis. I still don't understand the logic of any drug enforcement that says, we know this is an addiction, we know this is a medical issue, but let's jail you, let's cage you as a solution broadly. But what so even though they're doing better than they did before, I think that it highlights exactly the hypocrisy of where the solutions very often for the underrepresented, for the communities of color, is incarceration, the heavy fist of law. When it impacts white folks, it's more kid gloves, more embracing folks, to recognize that this is just a deep medical issue that's going on with addiction.
Our caller in Ohio, did that answer your question, ma'am?
Yes, that answered my question. Thank you.
Right on.
Thank you.
Roz, did you have a question for Mr. Shrewsbury?
I'm still listening at this point. Thank you, Gus.
No problem.
and retired firefighter in Florida. Did you have a question for Mr. Shrewsbury?
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, to the guests, you have been asked the question on whether or not you were a white person or a non-white person. And I would just like to say that for the most part, the people that have been questioning you are not, they are primarily are strangers to each other than this program. Most of us have never even met, so it's not like we collaborate to come up with this this idea.
Before I got here.
No, it just appears that you look very much like a non-white person who, quote unquote, used a metaphor, passes for a white person. Now, every time you've been questioned on this issue, you mentioned something that you mentioned some names, Cherokee, quote unquote, Native American, which I fully don't understand on what that means at all.
Indigenous people.
I would say if you are a white person, you are confusing non-white people. You're practicing racism. What is your take on that? That's just my first question.
I'm not sure that I understand. I'm not sure I understand your question. I'm sorry.
The question is, are you a white person or a non-white person?
So my answer is in two pieces. Biologically, I'm indigenous. That is, you know, what my heritage is.
Okay. Slow down. What does that mean?
So indigenous means the first settlers of America. So Native Americans is what some people call them, Indians. Indigenous means,
the first people. Wait a minute. I'm not that smart at history, but I would say the name America came up long after there was people in this part of the world.
Right, and that's why
I don't understand on where the term America has anything to do with what we're talking about.
Well, I'm not saying America. I'm saying indigenous, and we're talking about a plot of land.
Okay, and I ask you, what does that mean?
My heritage. Pardon me?
I ask you, what does that mean?
I'm not sure that I'm following your line of question. What I'm saying to you is that my heritage would be classified if the Census Bureau was, you know, to come ask me to check a box. Someone ran my DNA. My heritage would be classified as a mixture between Caucasian, probably a whole mix of stuff, but primarily a mix of Caucasian and indigenous or Native Americans, as it's described as the classification is today. My privilege, how I am viewed and treated in the world, is as a white person. If someone just said, "Are you a white guy?" I'd say, "Yeah, I'm a white guy." That's how I would always identify. There's no reason behind it other than that's my prominent features. There's more white of me than there is indigenous, but there's enough indigenous that's what where I'm classified biologically.
Okay. My next question is in reference to Daniel Holdsclaw. Have you or are you ever had a sexual relationship with a non-white person?
Yes, absolutely.
Past, present, past or present?
Past. It's me and my dog these days.
And your what?
I said it's me and my dog these days.
I don't understand that statement.
I don't have I'm not married. I don't have a...
Oh, are you indicating that you have sex with your dog?
No. I'm saying that's who my company is. That's who I live with. No, I'm not at all implying that.
Okay, my last question is, with your program, what do you expect the constructive outcome to be with your program?
Well, I think that first and foremost, I mean, the end result is to eradicate these injustices totally. Now, you know, is that a reasonable, achievable goal? Probably not. I mean, there's probably going to be this level of inequality in different ways in different areas, just as a part of
our society. I have a limited amount of time. What is the extent of what you say the injustice? Are you talking about ending the system of racism and white supremacy, as you were previously asked?
I have no illusions that we're going to be able to change. We're going to be able to end that. But where we believe that we can make an impact is at the point in which they're bringing police in the door, and that's at recruiting and training. So those are the two areas that we focus on. Some people focus on like mass incarceration. Some people, you know, focus solely on the drug war. We look at it to ask, who are you hiring? And what are you teaching them when you are hiring or when they're going through their training? Those are the two focuses that we're on, in which we believe that we can have some measurable impact in reducing the injustice in the criminal justice system. But that being said, is that, you know, we have no illusions that that, you know, even by correcting successfully correcting, you know, in any measurable way, that is going to be the total solution to all of the problems. It's not. There's just such a wide range of problems, especially in the criminal justice system.
But it won't end the system of racism, white supremacy, correct?
No. No.
Okay.
Well, I wish it would. But
thank you.
No. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus.
Indeed. I think we nabbed all of our callers, unless I missed someone. I'll give out the number again. If you have a question, you should get your hand up like right now, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have a question before we let Mr. Shrewsbury go. Again, the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform. You can go online. You can see their mission statement, who their directors are. When I looked at the images for the board of directors, it did seem like there were a lot of white people that were members of the board. Are there more white people on the board at the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform than non-white people?
There are. I think so, yeah. We're primarily female. There's more women on our board than I think than any other classification. But this is a very young board. We don't normally ask folks what their race is. But this is a small steering board that is really about the that's been in place for the operations and setup and that sort of thing. We today have over 60 volunteers all across the United States, in Australia, Canada, Germany, again, representing about 40 total different areas, different functions inside the organization, but the bulk of which is in the what we call community impact teams.
Wow. Well, I do not see any extra hands. I'll assume folks are satisfied. It has been a hoot, the exchange this evening. I will stick by what I said, Enian. We've had a number of whites, males, females, younger ones, older ones in the States and beyond who have come through over the years and presented a number of different frameworks where it's consistently, I would say, predictably, somehow white people, they are naive, they're unaware, they're unconscious, they're blind. Anything, everything, but willing, dedicated racists.
Yeah, I feel it's unfortunate that this is the part that we've kind of gotten hung on, because it wasn't an me absolving the white community to say, hey, don't feel bad for them. I'm saying it is what they are doing. It isn't a get out of jail for free card. It isn't looking to absolve anyone. But I think that this is sharing experiences in which evaluating not just whether or not white people can be racist, but what it means to be racist is a continuing, ongoing process in our society, mm-hmm. and a responsibility for white folks.
Something we take very seriously here as well, and just to remind folks, when asked earlier about following the logic, there wasn't any logic supporting.
No, there's no logic to it.
Blind
not at all.
Racist to
totally
describe
agree.
White people.
But there's lots
hang on,
of
hang on, hang on,
that
hang on, hang on, hang on. We've been around this. I just wanted to end there, just to remind folks that was stated earlier in the program, and I think that is hugely important. That is something that we have emphasized here for almost a decade. Follow the logic. That is hugely important in untangling the problem of white supremacy racism. Appreciate your time this evening, Mr. Shrewsberry. Glad we were able to get over the technical hiccup that got us started late, but we were still able to make it happen. We will keep an eye out on your work and hope we'll see who has a more accurate way, I guess, of understanding and putting a paradigm together to try to solve this problem. We appreciate your time and energy, Mr. Shrewsberry. Thank you so much, and we will speak with you down the road.
Thank you. And any folks who want to get involved and be a part of that conversation, go into our website, which is trainingreform.org. We're always open arms for more to the Lynn voice.
Outstanding. Randy Shrewsberry, thank you so
much.
Take care, sir.
All right. Take care.
Evening.
Bye-bye.
Context of white supremacy, Mr. Randy Shrewsberry. Images are very important. One of my pals who was very helpful during the whole flooding situation is a photographer. Images are very important. If I had not seen a photo of Mr. Shrewsberry, very different conversation. But just seeing that, either way it goes, he's still a racist suspect. I think that's very important, especially some of the questions that other listeners asked as well. I had such a chuckle. I've laughed at so many points during the discussion this evening, most of them while I was on mute, the best being Mr. Randy Short. But certainly I had a huge chuckle when our caller, Black Mother in Michigan, when she asked her consistent codified question about who's more confused about racism, and he said with great conviction, Mr. Shrewsberry did, that white people are more confused about racism. You can put that with the blind racist hogwash, dangerous hogwash acts of racism, in my opinion. Anywho, as I said, I think next week I'm going to try to see if we can return to something of our typical schedule, workplace racism Thursday, next Thursday. So that would be February 11th. The book club, Wisdom of Psychopaths. It was such a great book to be interrupted. And the compensatory call in, I'm going to try and pick all that back up next week. I've been having internet issues at the most recent temporary lodging place that I'm at, but that seems to be stable, at least for the moment. So if all holds, we'll try and get back to our normal schedule next week. But you can just check the Facebook page and social media sites. I should be posting a bit more regularly as I try and get back into the flow of counter-racist broadcasting. Thanks for folks for their patience while we were down for a bit. Do folks have any comments that they wanted to get in, what they heard from Mr. Shrewsberry, his commentary on the program, either? Certainly, if we have any folks who think this is a non-white person who just wants to be a member of the white supremacist team, and I think he's non-white, if we have any people who have that opinion, that would be great. Any other thoughts? Folks want to chime in what they heard from Mr. Shrewsberry. Proceed, and hopefully we can get it in concisely. Any comments?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, Gus. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak. I was just listening and learning this evening, and I think everyone asked very, very great questions. My main question was when I saw his image, I was like, he looks like he's, quote unquote passing.
And I thought that the firefighters' questions were really powerful to elucidate that. I just thought, yeah, absolutely, that he does not look like a white person at all. And for him to say that he's being treated as a white person, mm-hmm. I think this is just my personal opinion. I could be incorrect. But I think that his treatment might have come as a result of him being an officer, not necessarily because they thought of him as a white person. But I could be incorrect. Also, I just found that when you played the buckets and buckets of words, it was just that was one of the reasons why I held back asking any questions, because I just thought he was going to go rambling and rambling. I just didn't want to deal with that because his voice is kind of agitating, because he does sound very white. I don't, he just really sounds like a white person. I would just say my big thing, I would just say I think he's a non-white person who is in the act of passing and wants to be viewed and treated as a white person. But I think that it's something that might have actually been a byproduct of him being an officer. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, big victim.
I think I agree with Ross. I think they accepted him because he was a police officer. Also, when you listen to Norm Stamper speak, you know he a white man. But when you listen to Mr. Shoeberry speak, he came across as a victim. In my mind, and when I was listening to him, I said, this man is a victim. He's not no white person. That's how he came across to me. He didn't have an old city. He didn't have a seed. He didn't have that seed in him. That's how I took him. Thank you. Let me share, Gus.
Big victim in Alabama.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Yes. Yes. First of all, just like to state, logically speaking, as a non-white person who is a victim of race of white supremacy, I'm certainly not an expert on who is a white person, who's not, for logical reasons. But nevertheless, from my life experiences on the subject of racism, every action that he took on this program and answer to questions, it just still doesn't give me clarity on him being a white person. Even when I asked him, and he mentioned something about biologically speaking, quote unquote, and there's nothing biological about racism and white supremacy at all. It's a political construct as far as that concerned. So every answer he was giving was quite confusing on it, but nevertheless, and as I mentioned before, there's no collaboration on none of our part. And I haven't heard a person yet to state that he doesn't look like, well, I put it this way. Mm-hmm. I have heard not one non-white person yet on this program state that he is a white person, that he looks like, well, I put it this way, the quote unquote thing is that everybody is saying he looks like a non-white person, period. Still, that doesn't make him one, because we're all the victims of racist white supremacy. That's the hardest thing to overcome. It had to be a bigger forum with other white people, in my opinion, that would make that determination, that would make it more clarity on whether or not he's a white person. It has to be a pack of white people to be able to tell me that. Also, white people are quite clever when it comes to the global system of racist white supremacy, and someone that looks like him, I don't think they would mind him being around them, especially when they're doing some of the
atrocious, trifling things that they have and will do to non-white black people. And as long as he participates in it, I don't think they would mind. There was an incident that took place down here with the fire department, City of Miami Fire Department. I think you may have still been on the air then when that took place, whereas one of the people who got fired in that case where the black male was mistreated, it was obviously a non-white black male that was a part of that crew who mistreated this black male that got fired. So it's not impossible that he can't be accepted as he can't be accepted, you know, within that group as a non-white person. That's all I have to say to that. Thank you.
Appreciate that. I do remember that incident that happened in Florida where they had some non-white person was participating in this white supremacy campaign that they had against another black male on the fire department. And there have been a lot of different instances like that where race soldiers, they can
part of the people who murdered Emmett Till.
Oh,
yeah. Who participated in the murder of Emmett Till were non-white black males.
Yep.
You know, so it's not unusual.
Mr. Beauchamp talked about that as well. Absolutely. Did we miss anybody? Anybody else have commentary that they wanted to make sure they got in on Mr. Shrewsbury? Anybody else who had a hand up that we missed out? Oh, I heard someone.
Oh, hi. Yes, hi. This is a black female caller from New York. I was trying to get in a question, but I guess, you know, you didn't see my hand in the queue because I had to go away for a while. I know you were asking for me. I heard that came back. But anyway, I wanted to ask him a question about the this quote-unquote school-to-prison pipeline. And I remember prior to the hiatus, some of us were discussing how when we were coming up, there were no police officers in the schools. And I wanted to ask him about the training that they received and what is it so different about schools now and the curriculum now and the makeup of schools now with regard to the amount of non-white students compared to the amount of white teachers, particularly female teachers, that weren't police officers in the school. So I wanted to see what his answer was. And I think, you know, not to criticize anything, but I think that buckets and buckets of words could have been like way earlier in his these little dissertations that he was given. And I also wanted to just kind of like go off subject for a moment. If Rod is listening, I'm sorry. I just wanted to thank him for giving us that information on colloidal silver. I had a horrible dental issue. And had it not been for that colloidal silver, I don't know why that came to my mind other than like rinsing with salt water and things of that nature, and whatever else remedies we use in Advil. I went and I got some of that colloidal silver, and my gums healed up like so quickly, and I could still actually feel them healing. My swelling went down. I mean, that stuff is amazing. I went to Whole Foods and got some top shelf stuff, and I'm very thankful for it, and I take it every day. I noticed even a different, like, in my nails and things like that. So that colloidal silver, that'll do you. So I just wanted to thank him for that. And that's all I had. Thank you, Gus.
Hey, Gus, can I speak to the sister, the black female, briefly?
Yes, sir.
And to the listeners, too. I would suggest if anyone really wants to know, because the things that colloidal silver is good for, it's also good for rebuilding bones. And teeth and helping the healing of those that mm-hmm. But it's there's a website called thesilveredge.com, They actually sell machines that you can make your own colloidal silver there, but I got mine cheaper on Amazon. But on that site has the most comprehensive information about colloidal silver, and it will blow your mind the illnesses that people have cured. I actually cured an earache this past summer using colloidal silver, just three drops in my ear for 2 days, and did not have to go to the doctor, did not have to get antibiotics, none of that. It just killed it in 2 days' time. If it was not a bad one, it would have cured it in 24 hours. So I would just say go to that site, thesilveredge.com. It has the most up-to-date, comprehensive information about colloidal silver and the myriad of illnesses, cancers, and diseases like MS and lupus that it cures or literally provides relief on a level that is unprecedented. I just wanted to just throw that out to everyone, and I'm glad that you're getting relief. I know that Gus said that he also experienced that for himself. We saw it with my father-in-law when he was at the time he had bed sores before we lost him this past summer and last year. So I would just say that is something that Black people everywhere should make sure that they have, even if there's an emergency. I carry it with me everywhere. They sell like 10,000 part per million cream that you can use for any skin ailments or cuts or anything like that. So I would just say it's something that Black people, in order to avoid going to the hospital to be terrorized and for them to practice medical apartheid on you, it is something that will be essential if the economy collapses and there's some crazy situation that takes place and you're isolated. You want to have that in arm's reach to help you with a myriad of illnesses and potential diseases. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. Got my colloidal silver, had that this past summer when I had my wisdom teeth extractions. Was very helpful for me. I think we were talking about it on the program with that whole ugly situation. But yeah, I think quite a few listeners benefited from that. Grand to hear. Caller in New York. Glad to hear it helped with your issues. Anybody else who has picked up some has worked well. Definitely. Did we miss anybody? Anybody else who had a hand up? I thought I may have heard at least one other person who had a hand up. Did they have commentary they wanted to make sure they got in? We didn't miss anybody. Everybody who had commentary they wanted to get in, anything they wanted to share about Mr. Shrewsbury, we got them. We didn't miss anyone. Grand. I will assume we did not miss anyone. I thought I might have heard someone before, but I don't know if they got disconnected or if they hung up. All are satisfied, we will presume. Again, if you have sent emails, reached out in any way to Gus directly over the last 5 weeks, basically everything has been shut down pretty much since the flood. I'm slowly working my way back into things. So I will be going through and responding to emails and Facebook messages piled up, everything piled up. I'll be going through and responding. If folks wrote in, just give us a little time to kind of get back into the flow of things. Hopefully there will not be any disruptions, at least in the immediate future, with the housing situation, but we'll see how all of that goes. Thank you kindly to all the folks who tuned in today. Hope the context of white supremacy continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Folks certainly could have moved on and found other things to do, occupy their time while we were out and, you know, trying to deal with things here in Seattle. But good to hear everyone. Hope everyone is doing as best they can. Remaining codified, trying to take care of themselves and working towards solving this problem as soon as possible. Anything else folks need to get in before we wrap things up? Final comment?
Guess you got the Kyle's anniversary coming up next month, right?
Yes, we do. February 21, 9 years to the day, February 21.
I just want to say, just continue to take excellent care of yourself. Continue to heal. I have kept you and will keep you in prayer that your situation is resolved as quickly and thoroughly as possible. Just take good care of yourself. I'm looking forward to this year and however many years we have. Hopefully, we can solve this problem in short order. But if that's the case, you know, I'd rather share those years with you and these listeners. This is one of the most, if not the most important program that I participate in. And I just thank you for being you and thank you for all that you do for us. I appreciate you. Peace and love.
Much obliged, Roz. Much obliged. Thanks for the concern. Well wishes, other folks as well. Good to hear you all again. And yes, hopefully this will be resolved as painlessly as possible and can move on, get back on the grind, and continue with the broadcasting. Anything else folks want to make sure they get in before we wrap things up? I thought I heard a female caller, female voice. It was kind of low. Speak up if you were speaking. Not hearing. Thought I did hear a female caller, but was there anyone else that we missed who had a final comment they wanted to make sure they got in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Good job staying alive. The other thing I was going to say was, as far as this individual who was on the broadcast, perhaps he is not necessarily a white person. However, he said that he is a white person. He identifies with white people. He identifies with the albino and albinoid members of the albino colony coming out of Europe after the last ice age. If he identifies with them and he says he practices white supremacy and he's killing black people, and the consequence is the same. If you are killing black people, if you think that you're a white person, the consequence is the same. That's all. Thank you.
Right on. Appreciate that, Mhandisi. Did anybody else have a final thought they wanted to make sure they got in before we conclude? I'll assume folks are satisfied. Didn't hear anything else. We should be back on beginning next week a little more regularly. So you will have an opportunity to share your thoughts if you got left out today. Again, thanks to all the folks, their well wishes, their concern. I will reach out to Pam. We were supposed to have Pam on the program, but the disruption was so mighty that got botched. I had been talking to her in December, but I haven't reached out to her since all this ugliness happened. So I will get back in touch with Pam, see if we can get her on the program. And so much got rescheduled. This was one. We were supposed to do this program. I don't even remember the date. It was sometime back the week the house flooded, a month and a half ago. We were supposed to do this program and quite a few others. So just trying to go back and compensate for lost time, rescheduling, all of the dislocation trauma, do the best we can and proceed. But thanks for your patience during all of this, and hopefully we will get back to providing content that is constructive towards solving this problem immediately, the problem of white supremacy, racism, white people. That said, sobriety would be best. I think Mr. Shrewsbury, I think he said that they used to go out and do those sobriety checks and pull people over. Oh, think you swerved, might be under the influence. Sobriety would be best. I can definitely say during the whole time where the flooding situation, I saw other flooding victims where it was, hey, you know, let's have a drink. I'm feeling all bad. And we've been bounced out of our house. We don't know where we're going to be able to go back and, you know, drinking. And that just did not make the situation better at all. In fact, in some instances, that created new problems. And that is exactly, precisely what racist man, racist woman they have designed. We talked about having a yoga studio on every corner or alcohol on every corner. That's exactly what they want. Us not taking care of ourselves, us doing things that are going to break us down so that we can be more easily dominated. Black self-respect should translate into making self-care a major part of your regimen on a regular basis. As I said, if things are getting stressful, if things are getting tough, sometimes you just have to focus on the smallest possible things. Getting adequate rest, going to brush my teeth twice. I'm going to make sure that I'm doing vegetables. I'm not going to eat every cookie that gets brought in my direction, just little things that can have a huge impact on your health and well-being in the system of white supremacy where war is being waged against us constantly to undermine our health and well-being. Self-care, hugely important. Sobriety, huge, huge, huge part of that. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, especially if you're going to be behind a wheel, driver, or even as a passenger. You do not want to make it easy to be terrorized. I remember being out and about, I think it was on New Year's Eve, and they had the signs up all over Seattle about sobriety checkpoints, and they're going to be more of those. They're going to be more aggressive about that. I tried to tell as many non-white people as I could, be sober, be sober, be sober. Do not make it easy for them to make unnecessary problems for us. With that, thank you. Huge thanks to all the folks who dialed in, participated. Again, hope the cows is worthy of your time and energy. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.